Good morning, everybody. This meeting is called to order. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith, and congratulations, Mr. Smith, this is your first meeting, has a statement to make.
I do, thank you. Just want to make this statement that a public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551, the Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official minutes of this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Commissioner Brown, Finance Committee, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Did you want to grab it? Yeah, I have it. Hand you my gavel.
Thank you. I'm not sure what I'm going to do with
the power. They're going to be the power.
First order of business is approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Okay, we've got a motion.
You can name each commissioner that name.
I'm sorry again. Who? Commissioner Hickson, seconded by Commissioner Friedkin. Yes. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Can I stop you?
Yes.
Robert, sorry. We do have a new commissioner here today, and I apologize, Ralph. Ralph Duggins has just joined us as our new commissioner from up north, the Fort Worth area, and so please welcome Ralph. Ralph, welcome
Thank
aboard.
You.
Thank you. Yeah. Sorry, I skipped over that.
Okay. Is anyone opposed? None being opposed, the motion carries. Committee item number one is land and water plan update. Mr. Smith, please make your presentation.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. A couple of things, just as a point of departure, one of the procedures that we want to institute with all of our committees is to have a designated staff liaison, just to provide clarity for the commissioners as to kind of our single point of contact for each committee. Hopefully that will help with centralizing communications and coordination. And so I just want to point out that on our Finance Committee, Chairman, that we've asked Gene McCarty to serve in that role. He'll obviously be supported by Mary Fields in her capacity as Chief Financial Officer, but wanted to mention that for the record. A couple of other things that I want to bring up that I think are germane to this particular committee. I think, as everybody knows, our state park staff have been working very assiduously to institute new fiscal controls to help standardize our visitation counts, how we document our revenue. Many of those processes that we have are largely manual in scope right now, so they're not terribly efficient. So we have been working on putting in a new automated system that will be a new centralized, both a registration and a revenue documentation system. And our staff has been working with the company InfoSpirits to put that in place. I think we'll have that rolled out the 1st of November, and that'll be a big help to us statewide. And we're going to call that system our Texas Parks system. So anybody that wants to call in and make a reservation for a park, and then all of our documentation on every transaction associated with a park use will be put in place through that system. So that's been a huge Herculean project, and we're excited about that coming to fruition. I think also that most of you are aware that at the start of each fiscal year, we are given a base revenue estimate by the Comptroller's Office. Our budget comes off of that. It's an estimate of the funds that we will generate both through our Fund 9 programs, our fishing and wildlife and boater safety and law enforcement, and then also our state parks fund. During the course of the year, at mid-year, we have an opportunity to work with the Comptroller's Office to adjust those revenue estimates based upon our estimates of state park fees, oil and gas revenues, license sales, and so forth. And Mary and her team have been working with the Comptroller's Office on a revised estimate. It looks pretty good so far. We're going to submit a final recommendation to the Comptroller for her consideration. She'll review that, and if she concurs, we'll issue a certificate of fact on that, and then that will enable us then to hopefully have some additional revenue to be able to invest in our program. So we'll keep y'all apprised of that, and Mary may say a few more words about that a little later on. So that's the sum and substance of it. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Committee item number two is internal audit report. I think Ms. Cindy Hancock and Deb Best in the presentation.
Good morning.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Ed Beth, and this is Cindy Hancock from the Internal Audit Department. And we're here today filling in for the Audit Director to give you an update on the fiscal year 08 internal audit plan and our completed, active, and planned audit. As discussed in the previous Finance Committee in January, as of October of last year, all 16 additional auditor positions, as required by Rider 29, were hired and in place. Two positions were placed here at Austin headquarters, and 14 were placed in the field to cover all 8 park regions. We have 2 auditors at each of the larger 6 regions and 1 auditor at each of the 2 smaller regions. We performed a risk assessment on all parks based on park fee and revenue numbers and developed a schedule of park audits to be performed in fiscal year 08. You should have a copy of that. We started the initial or first round of audits for 9 parks in early November. Audit and review work is complete, and park audit response letters with management responses have been issued, and these will be included in the overall audit report, which Cindy will address in her portion of the update. We started the second round of audits for 8 parks in early December. Field work is complete, and review and park audit response letters are in the process of being completed. We started the third round of audits for 11 parks the third week of January. Field work is complete, and the review process will start in early April. And the fourth round of audits for another 11 parks started last Monday on March 24th. For the months of April through August, we have 48 more park audits planned. Some of these could be follow-up audits on parks that have material compliance issues, and this could change based on what the new audit director says he wants to do. If there are no changes, this will be a total of 87 park audits for fiscal year 2008, which is approximately 9% of the total number of parks. The internal audit plan for fiscal year 2008 is limited in scope, and it was based on the State Auditor's Office recommendation that we have an aggressive program to monitor and enforce implementation of the State Park Physical Control Plan. And our audit plan includes the following. State Park field audits, approximately 87, which we discussed, and overall audit reports for each of the 8 rounds of audit. We'll also have possible follow-up audits for problem parks, monitoring of headquarter-based state park issues, and any special projects, consulting, management, or training that is needed. Cindy will now give an overview of the audit report process and the overall report for the first round of park audit.
For the record, I'm Cindy Hancock, Internal Audit. As Ed stated, we've audited 9 parks in the first round. The overall report is scheduled to be formally released on Monday, March 31st, if all goes well. The fiscal control plan and visitation plan were developed to address a large majority of the deficiencies pointed out in the state auditor's report. These plans were developed by a cross-divisional team, including members from state parks, administrative resources, and internal audit. The objective of the fiscal control plan is to set a standard for basic business processes where these procedures can be implemented to improve internal control. The objective of the visitation plan is to provide statistical visitation data based on state park use and provide a uniform methodology to collect and report the data. We design the park audits to determine if the parks are complying with all procedures in these plans. So ideally, if the parks are complying with the procedures, the objectives of the plans are met, internal controls will be improved, and visitation data will be reflected more accurately. We first issued a park audit response letter to park management listing each non-compliant practice found during the audit. Each non-compliant practice listed has the correct procedure written next to it, citing which handbook and chapter it was taken from. This can be used as a tool to help park staff learn the proper procedures and where they can find them in the plan. After the park audit response letters were completed, we composed an overall or composite report. We extracted findings that had an impact or potential impact on park revenue and/or visitation. The overall report should provide executive management, the commission, and our oversight agencies with the information needed to determine if parks are complying or accomplishing their goals. The problems that come forth in this program are very similar to our previous audits. Internal control areas dealing with supervision and documentation need improvement in all 9 parks. We also found that two of the nine parks had not fully implemented some of the basic controls. Park visitation processes reflected numerous tabulation and recording errors, with most resulting in underreporting visitation data. Park management indicated that these findings listed in the park audit response letters have been addressed or are in the process of being addressed. I think you will find that because some of the procedures are new, compliance issues could be a problem in the first audit. However, as these processes become more familiar to park staff, compliance issues should lessen over time. That concludes our presentation. Do y'all have any questions?
Thank you.
I want to thank Cindy and Ed. I don't know if you all are aware, but maybe you did by just listening to this presentation, how much they're having to take on over and above what has been what I'd call the norm. So I want to thank both of you. And obviously this is ongoing, so it's a start, not a finish. Secondly, is I appreciate the attitude that you all have taken, because I think it's then made a lot of difference for people out in the field. And, you know, obviously it's created more work for kind of everybody. Plus the fact, I don't know if everybody on the commission is aware, Ralph, you're probably not, they've essentially had to take the responsibility on it of help train 16 other auditors who we've hired literally, what, in just the last few months.
Correct.
So Ed and Cindy have been a little overwhelmed, and I appreciate, again, the attitude. On the second side of it, I'm so pleased, though, that you're not finding really any patterns of any issues I'd call major, let's say. Am I saying that correctly?
I agree.
Yeah. And my understanding is you're getting good cooperation,
yes,
from the field, which, of course, is very
Park
important.
Park staff has been very cooperative.
Good. So I just want to make sure that I recognize formally both of you for all the extra time and effort that you all put in to get this thing moving. You had to get it up and running and then keep it going and keep the momentum going. And as you all may know, our internal auditor director had retired as this started. And so we're now in the midst of hiring somebody else, who we're going to talk about later today. I just want to give you two a lot of credit. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I'm sorry, Robert, I didn't mean to interrupt. But
oh, just... Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you. I
appreciate it. There's no action required on that. Committee item number three is an update on the State Auditor's Office audit of state parks financial processes. Scott DeBoer.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, my name is Scott Borough. I'm the Deputy Executive Director for Operations. I'm here today to give you the latest installment of the progress we've been making to implement the state auditor's recommendations and the related riders. I probably will do a little bit more detail again this time, since we have the new commissioner here. Just give you a little bit of background, Commissioner. This audit was this audit was actually started in late calendar year 2006, as we rolled into the legislative session, and we had made a pretty significant request from the legislature for additional funding for state parks. State Auditor's Office came out and did an intensive survey that ran from about November through about March of 2007, and so kind of in the middle of the legislative session, they issued a report, which, by the way, was pretty consistent with previous internal audit reports. I might take the time to second the chairman's appreciation for the internal audit staff here. Cindy and Ed have done a yeoman's job prior to this, to be honest with you. They had early on helped us identify some of the very problems that the state auditors came in later and also identified for us. There were 48 recommendations specifically issued by the state auditor's office. There were an additional five riders that we thought were very key issues for us to address relative to the audit items. So we put together a cross-divisional team to look at the 48 plus the five riders. I would like to take a minute to thank that cross-divisional team. It's been an extraordinary process here. It's been good for us. We've learned a lot. Obviously, State Parks has been intimately involved in this, both Walt Dabney and Dan Schally, but also his regional leadership, Brent Leisure, Randy Bell, Ellen Buchanan, Laird Fowler. I'm not going to name them all, and I apologize to the others, but all the regional directors have taken a major role in coming in to headquarters and helping us as a team develop the responses to this report and then take that back out to the field. In addition, administrative resources has obviously played a critical role. One of the things we did in the wake of the report is, as a management team, we got together and made the recommendation to then Executive Director Bob Cook and the chairman to go above and beyond the spirit of the report. We wanted to become the best state parks outfit in the country, and so we went into that with this spirit, that we were going to do more than we were asked to do, that we were going to set the bar high for both ourselves and for other state organizations as we tried to fix those problems that had been identified in state parks. And so we created an administrative resources under Mary Field's leadership and Gene McCarty's support there, a whole new shop that does nothing but looks at state park revenues and finances. Kim Dudish is the leader of that. I don't know if Kim's here, but she and her folks, and I think there's about 11 folks in that shop now, if I'm correct, have been an integral part of that team. And then in addition to parks and administrative resources, the Information Technology Group under George Rios' leadership and his staff, those three divisions, along with support from legal and the executive office, have really done an incredible job of putting together not just the responses to the SAO report, but to developing a system that we'll all be proud of when we're done with this. The objectives of the audit as defined early on were to determine whether the budget projections that we were going into the last session were appropriate and reasonable and were supported by documentation, and to, in particular, look at the deferred maintenance issues. Most of you are, I think, aware at this point, maybe not the new commissioner, that we at the time had in excess of $400 million in backlog capital needs across the state park system. So it was a major piece of the LAR that we put forward in the legislative session, was to get funding to help us address those capital issues, and so they took a close look at that. The audit report as it came out was divided into four major sections. The four sections were primarily business related in terms of management of state parks. Secondarily, was the infrastructure component. Fiscal controls, which was the final segment, was really the most important and most critical, and it's where we had the most problems. So a lot of what we've talked about in these reports are how we've managed the fiscal control piece. Executive Director Smith referenced in his opening comments the importance we place on getting those right and the system that we're trying to identify to make it more efficient, and I'll talk about that a little bit in just a minute. We are required to do periodic reporting to the SAO, the governor's office, and other oversight agencies that we work with. We have met all those deadlines. I'm not going to read all these bullets. You're certainly welcome to read them and ask me any questions. But we have, on time or ahead of schedule, submitted every report that we were asked to submit. Once again, I want to emphasize we've gone above and beyond. I want to give you a couple of examples. The SAO report asked us to identify and address fiscal control weaknesses. Well, we went beyond that. We developed comprehensive fiscal control plans for every park based on private sector and other state agency models that were out there. So we did a comprehensive look at fiscal controls, not a limited look at the fiscal control weaknesses. They asked us to address business weaknesses identified by SAO, which were fairly narrow and specific in scope. We took that and developed individual strategic business plans for every site. And things like visitation and revenue and those kind of issues were identified site by site, the potential for growth, the potential for improvement. I think the last slide there is very telling. There have been at this point 55,000 man hours clocked in regard to setting up and trying to implement these recommendations. And I want to point out that does not include the field staff's time to make these things work in the field. If we were capturing that, the number would have many more zeros behind it. This is the time that the team here in Austin, primarily with help from the field staff, have come in here and spent developing the system. It now, as Mr. Smith referenced earlier, it is out in the field. It is being implemented. You heard from the auditors just now that we are taking this seriously. not to say if we're going to be, stumble a little bit in the early processes, but we're committed to making it right, and it's moving forward rapidly at this point. We have completed 45 of the 48 recommendations, but we are substantially finished with this, with a couple of exceptions, which I will share with you here in just a second. Chapter 2, there are, and by the way, under Chapter 1, as we call it, Section 1, there are no remaining deliverables. We have finished that section completely. Under Section 2, there are two remaining deliverables, as you'll see up there. The first is the revamp or the relook at the Land and Water Conservation and Recreation Plan. And for those of you that have been here and the new folks, we do that every 5 years. It was last done in 2005. The next scheduled review and modifications for, and that's our operating plan. It's a little confusing sometimes, particularly the folks just coming into the agency. We have two strategic plans. The plan that I'm referencing here is our operational plan, the Land and Water Conservation Plan. It's the plan that drives what we do out in the field and how we try to address both our recreational and conservation responsibilities. We are in discussions right now with the, you ladies and gentlemen and the executive director about whether or not we want to move this up. It may be appropriate for us to do this before 2010, given the fact that we've gone through all these changes. So we will continue to keep you informed as to what the timeline is. Under the plan, we plan to do that in 2010. And so we will continue to have that discussion. The second task that remains in Chapter 2 is the development of a zero-based budget. I'm going to take just a minute on this one because, zero-based budgeting is an interesting phenomenon. As we found out and looked around the country, there are very few state park organizations that have undertaken that. We did find one. The state of Oregon has undertaken a zero-based budget exercise, and that verification is basically going in and looking at every single thing that happens in a state park. You've got to mow the lawn once a week, for example, and how long does that take? What kind of equipment does it require? How many quarts of oil? How many gallons of gasoline? How many man-hours? So it's very detailed, looking at everything you can imagine that would go on in the state park and building up basically a model that says this is what it takes, both in terms of man hours and in terms of dollars and in terms of equipment. I will tell you that the state of Oregon launched their ZBB, zero-based budget exercise, 6 years ago and are completed with about 50% of it. If you want to look at that in terms of the relative workload, you can imagine the number of state parks in Oregon are not near the number of state parks in Texas, and yet it's taken them 6 years to get that exercise complete. It's not easy. It's intensively man-hour driven. We will have it done about a year and a half from the time we started. This is going to be delivered in January, right at the beginning of the legislative session. We will have the zero-based budget complete. And it will, I think, set the foundation for us if we want to move forward under Rider 31, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, to look at what it really takes to have a high-quality state park system. This will be part of the foundation of that discussion. The third section of deliverables has one task remaining, which is the Rider 30 report, and I have two gentlemen here that I'll introduce in a minute from the private sector who partnered up with us to complete a study on the impact, the return on investment, if you will, on capital construction projects out there. Rider 30 essentially said for us to find someone in the private sector who had experience and competency in looking at return on investments relative to capital expenditures. We've been going through that process for many months now. I'll introduce the two folks here in just a minute. They're going to give you a briefing on where we stand on that. This is very important to us. Rider 30 is essentially the last piece of the puzzle that will trigger $69 million in capital funding, about $52 million in old bond money, in new bond money, and about $17 million in old bond money. So about $69 million of money. This is the final piece of the puzzle that will hopefully trigger that. I might mention that those are big numbers, $69 million. You might recall that $25 million of that is for the Battleship Texas, so if you pull that off, the rest is available for the other state park components. Last and certainly not least was the last section, which was loaded up with the fiscal control issues that both the SAO and our own internal auditors had identified. We are now complete with all the recommendations relative to that chapter. As Mr. Smith said, it's a pretty tedious process. It is labor-intensive in the field because at this point it's all manual. There's lots of pieces of paper to fill out, lots of redundant oversight that has to occur to ensure appropriate handling of money and those kinds of things. The fact that we are looking at a automated system that would link reservations and fiscal controls is something that once again represents our willingness to go above and beyond in this regard. This was not something that the SAO asked us to do, nor anyone else. It's something that we realized was good for business, would make us much more efficient. When we get this automated system in, we believe it is going to reduce the workload on the field staff. We'll have a lot fewer pieces of paper out there. Redundancy will be built into the system and won't have to be completely human-driven at the field site. I think it's going to loosen up some resources where we can get back to doing some of the customer service things that we've had to juggle at the same time that we're doing these fiscal controls. As you'll see from this slide, Rider 23 is an annual state park performance report, which is due in January 2009, and it will be completed. Major equipment report is due this October. We're on target to be completed with that. Rider 29 are quarterly reports, which we have been completing ahead of time, actually, by several weeks. Riders 30 and 31 are the two riders that we outsourced to Fisher Heck and Pros Consulting, which are represented by the two gentlemen here with me today. I'll introduce them in just a second. Rider 31, just as a preview, is the rider that asked us to look at what it would take to create a high-quality state park system, both in terms of funding, personnel, equipment, and those kinds of things. So these companies that are here today are doing both of those studies. They're doing Rider 30, which looks at the return on investment issue for capital projects, as well as Rider 31, which says here's what a quality park system would look like. For the automated system that I talked about, we selected the vendor just about a month ago who's going to be helping us with this process to make everything automated. We hope to implement that. Our actual target date is November. Prior to the session, we will go automatic with these fiscal controls. So we have four tasks left to go, and then we will be completed. Now, we will be reporting on this process for years to come, so completed is a relative concept in state government, but in terms of the actual work that's going on here, we will be completed with implementation. We'll get the zero-based budget exercise finished in January. The vendor studies, one will be done here in a couple of days. Rider 30 is due at the end of this month. Rider 31 is due at the end of October. The state park automation system, which I just referenced, will be ready to go rolling into the next session. And then we need to make a decision about when we're going to do the next land and water resource update, no later than 2010. Here at the table, I've got with me today Brian Trustee from Pros Consulting and Jim Heck from Fisher Heck Architects out of San Antonio. Other way around, this is Brian, this is Jim. Apologize for that, gentlemen. I asked them to come in today to brief the commission on where we are with Rider 30. Just as a reminder, this is the one that's going to trigger the $69 million in capital funding. Before I let them have their moment of fame here, anybody got any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
I just want to compliment you and the whole team effort that I think everyone in the agency has put behind this work. And again, you've done a fabulous job. We've come a long way in a short period of time. So thank you.
On behalf of the team, I appreciate that.
And how are you getting along with SAO, and what's their sense of it from your point of view?
We always get along well with SAO and all our oversight agencies, Mr. Chairman. I mean, it's an important part of our business, and we take it pretty seriously. We communicate regularly with the SAO. I talk pretty regularly with their senior staff person who's been assigned to this, Mr. John Young. Introduced him to Mr. Smith just last week. He was over here for another related audit that we're going through. I think, and at least in the letters that have come out formally, they have endorsed what we've done. They've said we're on the right track. So my perception is that they're happy with what we're doing, and they feel like we're taking it seriously.
So we're keeping informed as we move along relative to the methodology and follow-up. Okay.
Not just them, I might point out. I mean, we talk pretty regularly to all the oversight agencies. Yeah, yeah. We work closely with Tina Beck over at LBB. Yeah. We regularly communicate with the staff at the governor's office, lieutenant governors, and and Speaker's office. We work with Mr. Hildebrand and others over there. So, I mean, we try to keep everybody in the loop, and we certainly encourage their feedback, and they have been an important part of the team.
Scott, I appreciate it, because also this is going to tie into then Sunset, which we're going through also.
Yes. Okay. Dylan, you're on.
Well, we appreciate the opportunity. It's our honor and our privilege to not just be here today to share with you a preview of our results for the study we did with Rider 30, but also to be a part of this project as citizens of Texas and avid park users. This is something that was near and dear to our hearts, so it is something that we're very happy to be involved in. As Mr. Bohr mentioned to you, we've also distributed to you an executive summary of the Rider 30 report, which is going to be submitted to the LBB by Monday. And that report is substantially complete, as we are finishing some minor polishing at the end here, making sure we are ready to go and able to answer and address all issues and questions. I'd like to also reinforce this body's praise of the staff of this department. I know I do that also with the commitment from Fisher Heck as well, that this is not an easy study to go through, particularly when they started off this project with the statement of, we want to be better, we want to be the best, and we want to be able to address things that we need to do differently. Introspection can be a very painful process, and we want to honor the fact that this staff went into it with open arms and open eyes, and very receptive to whatever recommendations we have. We certainly have high-quality folks that are working to make this happen. Jim, did you want to make any other additional comments?
I think the only thing I do want to add, I do have from my office Jason Wynn. Jason's here to answer any questions you may have about any of the sites that we visited. Jason actually did go out physically to 24 of the park sites and did the evaluations on the site. So he's here if you have any questions in that regard.
Great. So today's presentation, we want to be able to make sure we take efficient use of your time. What we're going to do is provide you an overview of what we have done with this project, who we are, where we came from, and therefore kind of what the level of expertise and objectivity we're lending to the results. The key findings that we've resulted with Phase 1, and Phase 1 is the Rider 30 project, which is an assessment of capital projects, the 08-09 biennium, for state parks, that or whether or not they will increase attendance or revenues at those select state parks in which they're located. We'll provide you a progress report on Phase 2, which is the Rider 31 aspect. Again, an update of the schedule of where we are with outcomes, the kind of a detail of the expected outcomes we'd like to see happen as a result of our study and our work collaboratively with the department, and be available for your questions. So, again, the overview will consist of the objective of the project and the overview of who we are. The objectives were aligned with the legislative directives of Rider 30, particularly Rider 30A. 30 had 7 subcomponents, and the first subcomponent required the department to hire a private vendor to assess whether or not these capital projects will increase attendance at Texas state parks or generate revenue to cover costs. They appear to be fairly two simple questions, but of course, as you can imagine, they involve voluminous answers, because they're not necessarily easy to just go in and peg whether or not improvements to restrooms or improvements to ADA at a certain select parks are going to increase attendance or revenues. So we certainly dove into it as deeply as we could, and we'll get into a little bit of that process. Rider 31, as Mr. Borf mentioned, is again identifying the requirements for Texas to have a high-quality park system, basically identifying the gap of where we are now to where we're trying to go, and to lay out the strategy to get there. And of course, there's several subcomponents to that, and one of those is assessing public need, making sure we're developing a park system that is responsive to validated public need based upon demand and interest and trends in the state, operational enhancement recommendations, asset protection and improvement, being able to explore entrepreneurial opportunities maybe we haven't looked at before, or rethinking those that we have, and then, of course, the park development plan. Jimmy, you'd like to share a little bit about where you guys were?
Yeah, just to give you a little background, on our firm, we're a 16-person firm in San Antonio, and we were selected to be involved in this project primarily because of our background in site planning and also historic preservation, restoration, building renovation projects, because that's primarily what this Rider 30 was looking at. I do want to mention also that we have a team of consultants. We have a cost estimating consultant out of Houston who's looking at the cost estimating procedures. We also have a civil engineering firm, landscape architectural firm, mechanical and civil engineering firms that have also gone out and done site visits to go ahead and evaluate the various projects and conditions.
And I'm, of course, with PROS Consulting, and again, you can read the bullets, but kind of the highlight of who we are and where we come from. PROS Consulting is a niche consulting firm that specializes in management, strategic planning, specifically for government agencies, and uniquely in parks and recreation. We've completed 600 projects in 46 states and 5 countries and helped our clients and customers pass over $3 billion in bond packages supporting their park and recreation projects. So we use as a measure of our success the fact that we have a multitude of implementation plans that have been adopted by our clientele and put into action because they represent the best practices of the industry and are reflective of the political realities in which those departments are operating. So phase one, key findings. Again, this is a 138-page report that we're dropping on the desk of LBB and SAO and next Monday, but we managed to filter that down into 6 pages and an 8-slide presentation. Again, so here's the highlights, the 30,000-foot look of what we found. First of all capital projects should be allowed to move forward without delay. These projects are addressing reasonable and appropriate issues in state parks that are either deferred maintenance or maintenance that has come about within the last couple of years that need to happen. Continuing to delay those will cost the state additional dollars. Capital deferment is something that we're working with the department to help quantify so the state and the leadership of which you are accountable to can understand that there is actually a real cost to pushing off capital projects that are inevitable. All capital projects we found to be relevant and appropriate to the mission and obligations of Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. When we began this project and we got really into it and starting in January, we sat down and we organized a briefing session with several of the state's leadership of which were calling for this study to be conducted. And that included the State Auditor's Office, LBB, representatives from the Governor's Office, Lieutenant Governor's Office, Senate Finance, House Appropriation, and several other folks from the legislative leadership side. We're actually very pleased that everybody responded quickly to come in and sit down with us to talk about our objective, our process, and our plans for the project. This was something that we did completely independent from this department. It was important to us to be able to assure to that group, who's eventually the end audience of our study, that this is an objective process that is completed without the influence of the department, but based upon our own expertise and our own examination of the park system and where it's at and these particular capital projects. Because of the quick response we got from everybody on scheduling that meeting, we didn't know exactly what to expect, whether or not that was going to be a group that was very excited to hear what we had to say or a group that was going to be very critical of the process in which we were undergoing. We were very pleased to report that that was a group that met, that listened to what we had to say regarding our process, the procedures, the expected outcomes, and they validated everything that we were getting into the project for, and that was that essentially they want to just have a clear understanding of whether or not, what are the returns on investment for capital projects in state parks. They also understand parks are not something that are big revenue generators for the state, but we want to try to couch that in terms of reframing and repositioning the state park system to be evaluated more appropriately on its financial performance. So that was something that, I don't know, Jim, if you want to add any more to that, but we were very pleased, and we got a lot of validation from that group that we were going in the right direction.
Yeah, I think Brian summarized it well enough.
Good.
So additionally, we found that projected consequences of no action taken on any of these capital projects can be detrimental to park operations, the maintenance of state assets, and future park development opportunities. In FY 2007, the state park system operated at 65.50% operational cost recovery. That is a cost recovery ratio that is factored at the local state park level. So we're not including overhead or administrative costs that are attributed to park operations above the state park level. I will share with you, however, that the cost recovery ratio of the Texas State Park System, once that administrative cost is applied, is 53.6%. The national average for park system and their cost recovery operations is between 40 and 60%. So without including administrative costs, the Texas Park System is performing above average, above state and national averages. Even if you do include it, it is operating within the average range. So this is definitely a park system that is performing well or above average based upon how you look at it. There is an important note here, though, that it's very important for us, a message to get across, and you'll also find it here in this summary. Operational cost recovery is a performance measure that has been adopted really strongly in the last 10 to 15 years, judging the performance of state park systems or local park systems. It is not always the most appropriate performance measure because, again, parks are not generally huge revenue generators to generate huge public benefit as they're designed to do. Sometimes, and in this case, we would also advocate that the higher park operation cost recovery ratio we see with the Texas State Park System is not only a result of good revenue generation, but diminished operational budgets that are available to the state park system. So trying to get to a magic number of 85% or 100% is not necessarily what is advisable for a high-quality park system. Identifying that proper balance is a critical part of Rider 31 and what we'll be working closely with the department to do. Here's another interesting fact. Of 93 operating state parks, 40 of them had these capital projects located in them. So a little, roughly 40%, 45% of our state park system. These 40 state parks hosted 85% of overall state park visitation. These parks are being loved to death, and hence these capital projects. A lot of these capital projects are addressing the fact that these parks are under such heavy use, and that has accelerated wear and tear on the facilities. Each of the 98 projects were reviewed and analyzed. There were 98 capital projects, and here is how the results fell out. We found that 37% of them will likely increase attendance and revenues because they are bringing on facilities back online that have suspended operations due to their conditions, or they're bringing on new facilities online, they're enhancing facilities, making them more attractive to marketable use, etc. We found that 40% of the projects will not likely increase attendance, but are necessary to maintain current visitation. This relates to infrastructure issues. For instance, they may be addressing deficiency in water supply or wastewater systems or electrical delivery. Fixing those issues may not increase attendance or revenue directly, they are absolutely necessary for the park to maintain its current performance. We found that 45% of the projects will not likely increase revenues, but are necessary to maintain or improve the current financial performance of that park. So again, in the same vein. We found that 23% of the projects will not likely increase attendance and 18% will not likely increase revenue. The report goes into detail about what these projects are. Generally, these projects are addressing federal ADA requirements. They're addressing the restoration of historic structures that may or may not be in direct service to the public, but are a part of the park's portfolio, such as historic residences that are utilized by park managers. Again, so we're very clear in defining each one of those cases and why it is that we found that they would not necessarily increase attendance or revenues, but why they're important and appropriate for the department to conduct. We found that 20% of the projects, representing a total of 9% of the proposed capital budget, capital expenditures, are addressing federal ADA and state TAS, which is Texas Accessibility Standards regulatory requirements. This is an important issue, too, because even though, part of a high-quality park system is accessibility and equity for opportunity. So we need to make sure that our parks have a relevant and appropriate level of accessibility aspects to them. ADA compliance is a federal mandate, and the loss of compliance with ADA regulations can result in the loss of eligibility for the entire department to receive any form of federal funding, even if it's not related to state parks. So this is a minor investment to protect a much larger investment that this department receives and leverages against state tax funds to perform its duties above and beyond state park system. Finally, 18% of the proposed projects address repair and improvement to historic properties. 9% of the proposed capital expenditures are for historic buildings. That's not including the Battleship Texas, which is approximately 42% of the entire $69 million request. The battleship Texas is an interesting issue. I mean, this department has been given the obligation and the responsibility by the state of Texas to manage these historic structures. These capital projects we found to be appropriate and relevant to maintaining these historic structures and their historic integrity. So we did not find any fluff in these budgets. The battleship Texas is a giant project. But at the same time, the dry berthing of this facility is going to be unlike any other capital project in history. There has been no similar dry berthing of a vessel of this size. So we do believe that this project will have, or whatever, however you want to take that.
You didn't have to bring that up.
It definitely is in the long-term maintenance interest of this historic icon. It is currently undergoing massive amounts of hull corrosion sitting in the Houston Ship Channel. The only way to protect that and to actually make this a one fell swoop, and so you're not finding yourself biennium after biennium going back for more and more money to repair, make hull repairs, is to pull it out of the water and to make it an amenity that's an attraction not just for the Texas State Park System, but the region at large, because, again, it will be an attraction unlike any other. So that gets us through the key findings for Rider 30. Phase two is the Rider 31, and just kind of a snapshot of where we are. This involved extensive community and stakeholder input, of which we conducted a household survey across the entire state, representative of not only socioeconomic breakdowns of the state's population distribution, but where they're located. We have 254 counties in the state of Texas, and ironically enough, over 50% of our population only lives in 20 of those counties. So we wanted to make sure that our household survey was representative of the population distribution of the entire state. In addition, we've conducted extensive interviews with community leaders involving state senators such as Elliot Shapley, state representatives such as Gallego out in the west, mayors, judges, chairmen of community and economic development groups, Chamber of Commerce directors, and members of this very commission to get an idea of what they feel like are the perceptions of the current state operating circumstances of our park system, as well as what we need to do to get to a high-quality system in the long run. That has been a very enlightening process. We will also incorporate previous focus group findings that this department has conducted recently to make that a robust element of the project. We're 40% complete with our park and facilities assessment, which will, of course, get us to the park development plan, which we will deliver. We're anticipated to deliver to this this department a month before it's due to the LBB on September the 5th. It's due October the 1st. We're approximately 25% complete with that aspect. So again, our schedule, March 31st, we're done with Rider 30. October 1st, we're completely wrapped up with Rider 31. Finally, our expected outcomes. We are identifying attendance and revenue impacts of our current proposed projects. We have created an extensive and innovative and a unique capital project evaluation model that takes public inputs for public benefit, which are both tangible and intangible, and takes capital investment, capital return, deferment, the cost of capital deferment, projected increases to operating budgets or savings to operating budgets, and spits out a score for capital projects. And we're working with the department to make sure that that is an inclusive tool that you can choose to use in the future if you care to. But this was something that was very important for us to take from our peers in the finance industry and our peers in the parks industry and have a collision of trying to measure return on investment for something that's very hard to measure. We want to result in repositioning the state parks as viable assets. In Arkansas, they're finding diamonds in the state park system. We have diamonds of our own, and we want them to be known as such. So how can we reposition state parks as a viable asset to not only our citizens, but the visitors of the state? We want to strengthen the state parks as destinations. We want to create and improve our earned income opportunities. And we want to improve the value of the state park experience for visitors without having a huge impact on your expense bottom line. So we're trying to explore and identify where our opportunities are there. And with that, that's the conclusion of our presentation. We certainly are open to any questions you may have of us.
Thank you. Any questions?
Well, again, of course, I want to thank both groups for helping us in doing it so quickly, because this is... had very tight timelines on it. And Scott, maybe I can ask one question. I mean, kind of what are the next steps, and then how do we get feedback relative to this report?
The report will go to the oversight groups, the SAO and LBB and so forth, the next Monday, I believe. It will be, the ball will then be in their court to review the document and signal their support or approval of that document. We will certainly be down to answer any questions they might have as quickly as possible next week, and to be available to them and to stand ready to exercise our next step, which is then to go forward with the issuance of the bonds. That will be something the infrastructure division leads, but as soon as we get feedback from the LBB and the SAO and Lieutenant Governor Speaker's office, we will move forward with the fairly normal process that we've been accustomed to for many, many years. Our hope is to be able to get those bonds issued early in the next fiscal year, probably in September or October, then to be able to move forward with letting the design piece for most of those projects. That typically lasts 6 to 9 months on most projects, which will put us in construction towards the middle or latter part of this legislative session.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, John.
You don't. I love this report. I understand it completely. I want to be sure that everyone in Austin, all of our brothers down at the Capitol, understands it and understands the magnanimity of it, and also understand what Scott just alluded to, and that is the timeline of going into this, because I can see where if we do not make sure that every member of the House, every member of the Senate, and all the leadership understands that we've been doing what we were told to do, yet we have not been able, because of restrictions placed on us, we have not been able to begin the repairs on the state parks, and here we're going to be into the middle of a session. And we are also going to have studies done on other state parks that need repair that were not included in 30 and 31. So we're walking a tightrope balancing to make sure that all of our colleagues downtown understand this completely. And if they're happy with the report, then let's move forward with our next request, and it will come right on the tail end of 30 and 31. It would appear to be. I don't know. Dan, do you have any thoughts about that?
I agree with you. Yeah, I think we need to make sure that we do it in the time.
And this is a wonderful presentation, but we need to spread this presentation thoroughly in every office downtown.
I would add one caveat with your permission, Mr. Chairman, and that is that we've asked these two gentlemen to go downtown after the oversight organizations have had a little bit of time to digest the report and to be available to them to make sure that they understand the report, make sure there's any questions that they have could be independently answered by the consultants. So not only will the agency be downtown making sure we're available, but these consultants will also be there to talk about the report. And I probably would not be good of me to miss the two key points to this report, and that is that, number one, the infrastructure division, I think, has been borne out through this report. They know what they're doing, that they've put together the projects in a reasonable fashion, that have in fact been vetted by outside sources. I think that's something, particularly with Mr. Parker's help in that division, is reflects the long history they have of successfully expending the dollars. This will slow us down a little bit this time, but once that trigger is pulled, we will get after it. We've taken your directions and Mr. Parker's directions seriously to get as efficient as we can at this, so we're going to be bundling even bigger packages in the future. So I think the silver lining is here is we've done this effectively, done it appropriately. We have a track record of success in expending these funds, and we continue to continue that track record.
And please don't misunderstand me. No one. I'm not being critical. but you know, we need to look into the future, and we see January 3rd, 09 coming, and the conductor is going to holler all aboard.
Yeah. Now, John, I think Commissioner Parker is making a good point, but I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, only from the point of view, first Monday we have to get it downtown. And we've got to get it into all the various groups, that the leadership groups that must look at the report, and we've got to get it understood and accepted. And then I agree with you, though. Then we have to get out as an educational process, because the second part of it is there'll be a lot of legislators in January won't understand, well, wait a minute, we appropriated, we, you know, authorized and appropriated those dollars. How come they're not spent? And they're not going to remember that this was a big part of the requirement before we could even go out and sell the bonds. And this has to be accepted first before we can do it. So I agree with you, Johnson, but first we have to get agreement, I think, between all of the leadership at downtown and LBB and everybody else, that this report is acceptable to them. And the way we're going to get that is when they say, go sell the bonds. Once that's done, I think I agree with you, then we go out and get into the education process, particularly on the various committees that are our oversight committees, the individuals on them.
I have a question, Scott. Has the Lieutenant Governor appointed an oversight committee at this point?
An oversight committee?
Well, on the House side, did the Speaker appoint a committee to?
I believe you're probably referencing the sales tax.
Yeah, sporting goods tax.
Being sporting goods sales tax. There was an issue there. I do not believe the Lieutenant Governor is appointed in June.
No.
I think the House side.
It's strictly been on the sales, on the sporting goods tax.
It's on the issue of how much and whether to appropriate the sporting goods sales tax. It came up during the last session as a major issue relative to the funding of state parks. There was an interim committee supposed to be appointed. I believe the House has selected their members, but the Senate has not.
Okay.
I think also with all the various constituents who you're going to be educating and discussing the results with, this is a nice summary. This executive summary is great and helpful. I presume you're going to be distributing that as well.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
It's pretty fair to our legislators. A lot of them, I mean, this is what they'll look at. I mean, because this isn't their top priority. And so, you're again, getting back to John's point, yes, education is going to be key. But we've got to get it accepted first at the various levels, leadership levels.
And I think one of the key things that we did as a team was we had the two questions of increased revenue, increased attendance.
Right.
We really wanted to emphasize also the consequence of no action.
Yeah.
Because that really puts you, you know, you have a roof that's leaking, that's easy to fix. You wait a few years, you have rotted deck and interior damage, and it's a lot more expensive. So those consequences also were something that we thought had to be really answered in this.
Well, I appreciate it. And people stop coming.
Sure.
I'm in there and it's dripping on me while I'm sleeping at night. You know, that's not what I paid for.
You have to go on good weekends where it's not raining.
What was the timeline? I'm sorry for my late arrival, but what was the timeline on distributing this?
Monday. It gets out to the various leadership groups, governor, lieutenant governor, speaker of the House, LBB,
SAO.
SAO. And the report will literally go Monday to all of those groups.
And we are in the process the team's in the process of trying to set up a meeting with all of those groups. We you know, a similar meeting to what we had before with them.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Did a good job and did it quickly.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mini item number four is the financial overview. Mary Fields and Julie Horsley present.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Mary Fields, Chief Financial Officer, here to provide the financial overview. The focus of the presentation today will be to provide a revenue and budget status for fiscal year 2008. And again, I'll introduce Ms. Julie Horsley. She's our Director of Planning and Analysis, and she will provide a status update on the strategic plan. And finally, I will wrap it up with an update on our 2010-2011 legislative appropriations request. Start out with the revenue and budget status. And I want to start just with a reminder here that the comparison of the state park receipts has been revised to only include continued operations. We want to make it more comparable to the prior years. So the receipts from the historic site and the Texas State Railroad that we are no longer operating are not included in the 07 totals or in the first part of the 08 totals. When comparing the state park receipts through January 31st at $11.35 million, we're up 9.5% or $988,000 over last year's collections at the same time. The most notable increases are in interest fees and facility fees. We're doing real well for the state park receipts. This will be very helpful for us in the revenue estimates that Mr. Smith mentioned earlier in the land and water bullet. Our boat revenue as of January 31st is at $5 million. This is up 2.7% or $132,000 compared to last year at the same time. Boat registration revenue is down slightly, while revenues for titles issued and sales tax is up. We continue to transfer that 15% of registration and titling revenue to Fund 64, our state parks account, and that amounts to about $637,000 based on the revenues through January. More good news here with license sales revenue. This is also up as of the end of January. At $68.8 million, we're up $2.1 million in revenues as compared to last year, or 3.1%. All of the categories of revenue are higher than the previous year, except for resident hunting, which is down 1.8%. However, the combo sales are up 2.4%, so this could just be a shift in license purchaser preference. The other category is also just slightly down from the prior year. In reviewing the number of licenses sold at 2.11 million, we're up 6.1% as of the end of January. Total hunting is down 0.8%. That kind of drives with the revenue we just talked about. Fishing is up 14.5%, and freshwater is really driving that percentage real well. Total combo sales are also at 3%. When comparing our 2008 revenue collections as of January 31st to the annual revenue estimate, we're doing well with all of them, which is no surprise that we just talked about the growth in all the revenue categories. With 42% of the fiscal year elapsed, we've collected 60.8% of our game, fish, and water safety funds, 40.3% of state park funds. The local park fund is at 42.8%, and the other category is at 104.6%. There are multiple funds included in that other category, and there are a couple of them that are doing real well, and that's what's driving the percentage up. Our overall budget has increased by $18.3 million since November 30th, taking our budget to a total of $442.9 million. Budget adjustments made during the months of December and January are summarized on this slide. The largest adjustment was to recognize the portion of bonds that were appropriated to us this year and were approved by the voters in November. These are the Prop 4 bonds. There's half of the battleship bonds are in there at $12.5 million, and the remaining $2.1 million is the portion of the bonds for state park repairs that was included in this fiscal year. You'll see the rest of it appropriated in next year. I will mention that the bonds are unissued at this time. We did want to go ahead and recognize them since they were approved by the voters. The schedule, and speaking with Steve and Scott also talked a little bit about that earlier, and the schedule is to get the bonds, first to get that rider business, the Rider 30 business plan approved in those projects. Yeah. We're hoping to have that done hopefully by the end of April. Of course, we don't control that. If all goes as planned there, we'll request funding from the Texas Public Finance Authority in June. And we'll request further approval from the Bond Review Board in July. And then I think there are plans again to really issue those bonds in September or October. Steve Winston, our infrastructure director, I believe, has a presentation planned for the May Commission meeting. And he'll talk more about all of these projects and the plans during that time. The other sizable adjustment is the carry forward of unexpended balances there at about $2.8 million. The majority of that are federal grant funds that are being carried forward. In reviewing our fiscal year 2008 budget versus expense, we have 69.5% of the budget remaining with 42% of the fiscal year elapsed. The salaries and operating categories are basically on track. The capital expenditures include construction and capital equipment. Of that $59.1 million, $50 million of it is construction. Just a reminder that those construction projects, we do, when they take 3 to 4 years to complete, and so see a pretty good remaining balance there, but you'll see as this project rolls from year to year over a 3 to 4 year period, you'll see those balances drop. And again, Steve will cover more of that, I believe, in the next meeting.
Steve, you lucky guy. 3 to 4 years? You're going to explain 3 to 4 years?
I asked him.
I know, Mary. No, I pick on him all the time. You're talking about from start to finish, right, when you say that. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, we start talking about the bonds and the construction projects. That's definitely out of my purview.
Yeah, pass the book. Yeah, well, I don't blame you.
Moving on here, at this point, I'll hand it over to Julie to give the status update on the preparation and the strategic plan for 2009-2013. And just a reminder here that this plan is called the Natural Agenda. We do have the two strategic plans. You heard Scott earlier talking about the Land and Water Plan, which is a strategic plan that we operate with. The Natural Agenda is more of the strategic plan that we use when we're dealing with the legislature and our oversight agency. It is still a key driver for us in performance and other measures as well. So at this point, I'll hand it over to Julie.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Julie Horsley. I'm the Director of Planning and Analysis in the Administrative Resources Division. I'll just add a little bit more to the comments that Mary just made. The Natural Agenda is more of a legislative strategic plan. It really establishes the budget structure for the agency and serves as a mechanism for us to identify any anticipated funding needs that we have. We do make an effort to link the Natural Agenda to the Land and Water Plan, and I'll discuss that a little bit more later on in the presentation about how we're planning to do that this time around. Just as some background on strategic plan, the requirement for strategic planning was established by the legislature in 1991. Provisions of the government code require that all state agencies engage in strategic planning and prepare and submit a 5-year strategic plan every 2 years. So this time around, we're working on the plan for FY 2009 through 2013. All agency plans have to include specific components as required either in statute or via the instructions that are issued by the LBB and the governor's office. For example, all plans have to include mission statement, goals, objectives, and strategies, an internal and external assessment, and then a set of measures to gauge progress towards achievement of those goals and strategies. The budget structure, the goals, objectives, and strategies that are developed as part of that strategic plan form the budget structure for each agency, and it's that's used as the basis for requesting one split appropriations. In terms of the due dates and processes, any proposed changes to budget structure have to be submitted to the LBB and the governor's office by April 16th. Once those proposed changes are submitted, there's usually a set of meetings that occurs where we negotiate and review the proposals, and final approval of those structures rests with those two offices. The final strategic plan itself, the document which incorporates that approved structure as well as other elements, is due July 11th. Internally, we do rely quite a bit on division input into preparation of the strategic plan. Back in January, we asked all the divisions to begin looking at their budget structure and performance measures, and we received proposals from them, and I'll be reviewing those with you over the next couple of slides. They've also been asked to provide input into the actual text of the strategic plan. In terms of the proposed structure changes that we plan to submit to the LBB and the governor's office, we are requesting a revision to a total of 3 strategies. The first set of these changes has to do with our existing inland and coastal fisheries management strategies. Right now, we have two separate ones. One deals with inland and one with coastal, and our proposal is to consolidate those into just one strategy. We feel that that's going to be, you know, an appropriate change and beneficial to us. Right now, there are some fisheries management activities, particularly in resource protection area, that are more statewide in nature and don't easily lend themselves to categorization into one division or another. And this change will reflect that. The other change that we have is in the park support strategy, and it's really just a minor wording change to reflect that the activities conducted in that strategy are management related as opposed to direct provision of services. We are also going to be moving forward with a request to change several of our measures. In all, we will request deletion of 15 measures. Two of those deletions have to do with programs that are either been scaled back or are being eliminated or have been eliminated. There are five measures in communications in the State Parks Division that we're requesting deletion of, but which will be replaced with new indicators. And then finally, there are eight, four in inland and four in coastal, that are being deleted due to the strategy consolidation I just spoke of. We will move forward with a request to add a total of 11 new measures. Two of those are in the Wildlife Division and would allow that division to better reflect their efforts related to endangered species research and wildlife management on private lands. Then there are four measures within Communications Division, and that's basically kind of the flip side of the deletion. We're asking to delete some, but we're replacing them with some indicators in Communications Division that are more to reflect the programmatic, some programmatic shifts that have occurred in their programs. One state park measure would focus on the state park volunteer program and capture information on the value of volunteer labor in that program. And then four measures, those last four there, would reflect combined inland and coastal efforts under the consolidated strategy. So basically we're eliminating eight measures, but we're kind of collapsing them into four that capture both inland and coastal efforts. And then finally, we'll be requesting revision to a total of 21 measures, and these are really minor changes to measure definitions, not to the measures themselves, just for clarification and cleanup purposes. In addition to the proposed structure changes, we're currently working on updating the text of the strategic plan, including sections on key events and legislative initiatives and strategic priorities. And it's really within the text of the plan that we've tried to link up to the land and water plan, and this is one area I wanted to focus on. We try throughout the text of the plan to be consistent with what's the message that's in the land and water conservation plan, so we make every effort to do that. But also within the strategic priorities section, we kind of attempt do a crosswalk between the land and water plan and the natural agenda. That section, kind of similar to how it was laid out in the last strategic plan, we are planning to organize it according to a major land and water plan goal, and then within each land and water goal, lay out the key issues and challenges and the key accomplishments, and then link and show the relevant strategic planning and budget structure goal that links up to that particular land and water goal. We hope to provide you more information on each of these sections at the next commission meeting, and hopefully by that time we'll have a draft ready for review and circulation. And then once we get comments back on that and are able to incorporate them, the final plan will be submitted to the executive director and the chairman for review and signature. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Back to that work, you're going to consolidate inland fisheries. I may not have understood exactly what your wording was, but are you saying that we're going to combine inland fisheries and coastal fisheries? into just one division?
No, it's actually a strategy change. It's not a divisional change. So in terms of the way the funding is appropriated, it would go into one strategy, and it could still be split between two divisions.
Could I add to that, Julie? Just Commissioner, there are a number of strategies that span the work of both divisions, and given that, you know, they're functioning across watersheds. So, yeah.
When will this be submitted? I may have missed that.
The final strategic plan is due July 11th.
Okay. Good. I think it'd be helpful if we could get that crosswalk you're talking about between the natural agenda and the land plan, just to understand the totality of the strategic planning process.
Good point. Any other questions? Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you. I'll move forward to, I have one more section here. The strategic plan does lay out the needs for the agency, which then we proceed with in our legislative appropriation request if there's funding needed. So I do want to give you an update on where we're at with our, I'll call it the LAR, just to shorten it for us, the LAR update. Let me mention just a couple of key points about the LAR for commissioners that are new to the process here. The base budget for 2010 and 11 is really established based on our 2008 projected expenses and our 2009 operating budget that we'll establish. When we establish that base, then the Legislative Budget Board and the Governor's Office can establish limits to that base. Last biennium, we were asked to limit the base to 90% of our general revenue and general revenue-related funds. While there is not a directive that's officially out there yet, we have heard that there is a possibility that we will be asked to limit our base again this time. We won't start out with 100% of our base budget. With the base budget, if there are any additional funds that we want to ask for, we ask for them via exceptional. And it's a good idea to try to limit those number of exceptional items basically to around 5. Is when you're discussing it with legislators and during the session, they kind of start losing attention after you get past past 5. So I think last year we ended up with 7 exceptional items, and we were pretty successful in actually getting attention on almost all of those. So we'll move ahead there, and we're still working on our list of what those exceptional items might be. We are, as far as developing the LAR, we will be beginning the operating budget process for 2009 here in April, and we are still working on our timeline here for the LAR preparation. We know it'll be from April into August. We do anticipate the receipt of the instructions from the LBB and the Governor's Office in late May or June. I think last time we got them in early June. But we've started already with our base reconciliations and all that sort of thing. So, and then again, the LAR will be due in August, and it looks like it'll be, based on some of the other due dates, it'll probably be late August. So that's kind of where we're at. In the next meeting, we'll talk a little bit more about where we're at with the legislative appropriation request, as well as another update to the strategic plan. And that concludes my presentation. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Is the strategic plan document submitted with the LAR to the legislature?
No, the strategic plan is actually submitted in July. So it'll be submitted July 11th. And it'll begin review and circulation. And then the LAR is actually due in August. During this session, they will reference both documents, but they're not submitted together. They do have separate due dates.
So they see our strategic plan approximately a month or 6 weeks before our actual request.
And it will lay the groundwork for some of the needs that we'll be, you know, again, asking for funding for in our legislative request, appropriations request.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Jed.
Committee item number five is facility use fees at the Perry Haynes Ranch, and we're going to be asking for permission to publish. And Mr. Ernie Gamage is going to make the presentation.
Commissioners and Mr. Smith, good morning. My name is Ernie Gamage, for the record. I'm the branch chief for the Urban Outdoor Program section of the Communications Division, and I'm here today to request your permission to publish amendments to the fee schedule for the Perry Haynes Ranch. Let me see if I can get that picture up there. It's a beautiful shot. Many of you have been up there, but some of you have not. And I'd like to give you a little bit of background about the ranch. It is a 4,500-acre facility located in Bell County near Killeen. It actually abuts Fort Hood. We have two black cat vireo and also a golden sheep warbler up there that run back and forth from Fort Hood. We lease this facility from the Texas Youth Commission. The current lease expires in 2018, and the donation of the property originally was made for the benefit of the children of Texas from the late Perry Haynes. The ranch itself is divided into two parcels. The eastern parcel is known as the Equestrian Center. It has 26 campsites, over 60 miles of marked trails for equestrian use, and is certainly a highlight of the system. The western parcel we call the Hilltop Complex, and it provides facilities, lodging. It's where we provide meals to groups and also activity opportunities. And in 2003, the Camp Coca-Cola Foundation began an investment of over what is now $2.5 million of commercial kitchen, dining hall, nine camper cabins, a home, swimming pool, pavilion, a bunch of other stuff. The current fee structure does not include all these facilities and activity uses, and we want to speak to that issue, nor does it allow us to recoup operational expenses. Our proposed fee schedule will provide a base fee for all users for overnight lodging, meals, and the various activity opportunities out there, which include five-stand shooting sports, a ropes course, swimming pool, kayaking, fishing, and other opportunities. It does provide a discount of 40% for youth groups that use the ranch, and we are defining youth groups as any organization that has over 60% youth 17 or below as their makeup. This is not like a state park. You don't just come out there. It's by reservation only. And the proposed fees will provide a fee range that will later allow us to amend upwards any of the fee that we wish to increase. To give you an idea of the fee comparison, right now, for example, in the current schedule, we have the entire Hilltop Complex that can be rented per day, 24-hour period, for $1,000 to $5,000, and we are proposing increasing that fee $2,250 to $3,500. This is based, by the way, on an examination of similar facilities around the state, including some of those from LCRA and other private camps and facilities. One of the issues related to cabin use is that we did not have a fee established for the rental of a single cabin used for campers, and we are addressing that by proposing a fee range of $400 to $600. And finally, a bunk in a cabin, the current fee is $20, and we propose raising that to $30. With your permission, we will publish these in the Texas Register for comment, and then they will be approved at the next committee meeting. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Where did you come up with these numbers? Have we talked to some of the user groups that use it on a regular basis?
We surveyed similar facilities around the state. I think we talked to somewhere between 8 and 12 of them and got their published fees. And this is based on that.
But other than that, we really haven't talked to any users yet. So we'll do
We did look at our current users and what they have traditionally paid and what we believe they will be willing to pay.
We'll find it in the public.
What creates the range on the renting of the Hilltop Complex?
Well, when we first put that together, and we've never actually rented the entire Hilltop Complex, but based on the availability of bunks and so forth, that was our wild guess, and we have amended that to raise the floor, again, based on individual fees for renting cabins and the meeting facilities, but lower the top range. We feel like we won't have an opportunity or a need to take it up to $5,000.
But with different groups for some particular reason pay a different price?
No, that range is from the floor all the way up to what we could sometime in the future without having to come back to you, gentlemen and ladies, raise the per day fee. Okay. And all of these ranges are based on a 24-hour use.
Ernie, it might be helpful to describe for the commission what all is encompassed within the Hilltop complex. It's pretty extensive, and that's why you're seeing that fee right there.
So. Right. The Hilltop complex has a dining hall that seats 160 folks and a commercial kitchen. It has a really nice pavilion, outdoor activity area, an open-air pavilion. It has 9 camper cabins. It has a 4-bedroom home. It has a Swiss chalet type lodge that also has lodging in it, and then it has grassy fields. We have a 5-stand shooting range. We have a campfire ring for campfires, a swimming pool. There's a lot that you can do at the ranch.
Ernie, you brought up something on food cost. How do we recoup that? Is that just included in this?
We offer a range of menus depending on whether or not you want shrimp and steak or you want, you know, baked potatoes or french fries.
Right.
And we allow the individual user to choose that menu and it's priced accordingly. So it is mentioned, but it's not on the slides here.
Okay. Thank you. Any other discussion? If not, no further questions, I will authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next is committee item number 6, Internet sales of big time Texas hunts. Darcy Buntempo.
Good morning. Good morning, commissioners. For the record, my name is Darcy Buntempo, and I'm the marketing director here at the department in the communications division. I'm here this morning to present an action item on internet sales for big time Texas hunts. This program has been a successful revenue generating program since 1999, and last year we brought in about $799,000 in gross revenue to the department. That revenue funds such things as wildlife research, habitat management, and public hunting opportunities. In addition, beyond generating revenue, the program gives hunters the opportunity to win one of 7 premium hunt packages. Participants pay $10 an entry. They purchase an average of 4.5 entries, and most of those, 84% of all participants, enter by mail. As you may know, the Parks and Wildlife Code requires the commission to set fees for participation in public drawings. And that's why I'm before you this morning. In January meeting, we did receive permission to publish the proposed amendment in the Texas Register to authorize the sale of big-time Texas entries at $9 versus $10 if they were purchased online, and to clarify that the existing $5 convenience fee per online transaction occasion applies to big-time Texas hunt program. And I just want to also clarify that $5 convenience fee is the same no matter how many entries or other licenses you purchase during that one shopping occasion. So that's a one-time fee no matter how many entries or licenses are purchased. The expected benefits are we expect with this promotion to increase the number of participants by offering this reduced price option. The promotion will allow us to put promotional messaging on hunting-related websites, which we believe will attract out-of-state as well as in-state hunters, and with a link to purchase, so it's very convenient for them to then purchase entries once they learn about it. It also provides a news peg for press releases. This is a maturing program, so we see this as another benefit. And another key point is direct mail continues to increase every year for us. Printing and postage continues to increase. And we plan to use this promotion as an opportunity to encourage those online buyers to sign up to receive Big Time Texas Hunts information next year by email as opposed to mail. And we're hoping that we will let them know that will help us save money, that will therefore then increase the proceeds that go directly to benefit the programs I mentioned earlier. So, and then finally, it's an opportunity to raise awareness of the online option for all licenses. Right now, about 2% of hunting and fishing licenses are sold online, and we see that there's room to grow this. We received 29 comments, about 66% of those agreed with this rule change. The 10 disagree comments, we had 3 opinions that were provided that related to Big Time Texas Hunts. One was a concern by an elderly person that perhaps older hunters might not have access to the internet. One other opinion was that they'd had a bad experience in the past regarding purchasing online with our website. And one other was just a comment that felt that the price should be the same for all entries. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Kirstie, how long has it been at 7 for since program inception, 7 hunts?
Well, we've had a few hunts change over the years, but I think it was originally 6. I think we added one more. But it's been 7 for probably about 5 years. So
in terms of expanding the program, have we thought about ways to expand that number on the supply side?
Well, we are actually getting feedback. One of the things we're also going to be doing with our email blast, as we call it, we're going to be actually asking hunters to take a survey. I think this came up in the last commission meeting, to give us feedback on any ways they'd like to see us improve the program, including adding more hunts. We're always trying to be very sensitive to the fact, though, we do not want to cannibalize the program. Some of the experience we had in the past was adding hunts or even more winners per hunt didn't actually increase the number of entries. It just increased the number of costs. So every hunt we add does add costs. So we're trying to do that. We are going to be getting feedback, and we look forward to sharing that with you when we get that at the end of this program. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Mr. Chairman, this committee has completed its business, and we'll move on to the Conservation Committee. I'm going to pass the gavel to Commissioner Seven.
Yeah, delegate. Don't throw it at the poor guy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first order of business on the Conservation Committee is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have been distributed. Is there a motion for their approval? Moved by Martin, second by Parker. Thank you very much. Committee item number 1, land and water plan update. Mr. Smith, please make your presentation.
Thank you, Chairman. One of the things we talked about in the Finance Committee this morning, I think before you were here, was that for consistency and kind of coordination purposes with the Commission, we are designating a specific staff person to serve as the official liaison with each committee and to help with working with you on setting agenda items and priorities and working on that kind of on a priority basis. And Scott Borough will be our designated liaison for this committee. Just a couple of quick updates on the conservation side. I don't know if y'all get our regular updates about big bass caught around the state, but there has been a proliferation of those lately in public waters, not just in Lake Fork, by the way. I had always operated under the assumption that serendipity and divine intervention had something to do with that, although Phil has assured me it's due to our exemplary management. So kudos to that team for what's happening around the state. We've got our second annual Toyota Bass Classic coming up in Lake Fork, April 18th through 20th. I hope all of you will be able to join us for that. It's a great event that is sponsored by Toyota and the Professional Anglers Association. Toyota helps support our conservation education and inland fisheries programs with proceeds from that to the tune of about $250,000. So it's a very substantial investment. We're very, very grateful for that philanthropic investment. Also, a few words just about the East Texas Fish Hatchery. I think as all of you are aware, the revenue from the sale of the freshwater fishing stamp has been allocated to help us with the construction of that new fish hatchery in Jasper. We have just received the formal bids to conduct the construction on that hatchery. We are in the throes of reviewing those. We expect to finalize a decision on a construction contractor in May and hopefully initiate construction sometime towards the late summer. So we're excited about the development of that. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah, no, that didn't take too long, has it?
we're here now, so I'll look to the future. I think also many of you heard about the wildfire that we had down at the Chaparral Wildlife Management Area. You know, this is our premier research and demonstration area in South Texas. I know we have Lynn Palasik, our South Texas Regional Director for Wildlife here. That wildfire broke out on March 14th, swept through the wildlife management area. It burned about 95% of it. Also burned another 60,000 acres of surrounding ranch land. We did lose our research facility there on site. We had tractors damaged, a whole series of water lines around 50 miles perimeter and interior fences. And so suffice to say, the team has been very, very busy addressing kind of the outfall of all of that. But they've done a great job, Scott and Lynn and Mike, really proud of how everybody has responded to that. One of the things that I think we're looking at going forward is, you know, for better or for worse, we've just been given a new 15,000 acre outdoor laboratory to look at the results of this fire in South Texas. And so our team is putting together a list of research priorities that will help hopefully drive some of the research that goes on in the future. And we are very, very excited about that. We are going to need to find funding to help with the construction of our research facility there and some of the other equipment. But just wanted to give you all an update on that front. And Lynn and Mike and Scott and everybody, thank you for all of your hard work on that. I know that was a difficult time, came right at spring break, and so people were scattered here, there, and yon. David Sinotsky, our manager, was off at a wedding somewhere in East Texas and had to come back. So, but the team did a great job on that. So
we self-insure all the facilities and all that. It's basically
the self-insure. Yeah. We don't have any formal insurance program, right. So we're responsible for the infrastructure repairs.
Right.
And that. Yeah. I think that's it.
Very well.
Yes. Thank you.
One comment I would make on our new laboratory on the fires from 2 years ago when the Panhandle Range fires, they did a great photographic essay by placing T-posts or whatever markers in certain areas and taking sequential time-lapse photographs just to show the progress. And if possible, if we could do that intensively in this area with various soil types, various vegetation types and whatnot, I think that information would be very valuable.
Yeah, I agree. As I understand it, we've got photo points already set up and in the ground to address those various issues. Scott and Lynn, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. Lynn Palasik, so our
sure.
South Texas Regional Director. Yeah, so good counsel.
And it makes it, you know, the benefits, I'm an advocate of controlled burning, and the benefits of such are very well portrayed in that way. Thank you.
Can I ask one question?
Certainly.
Are we going to work with other groups too, A&M, Caesar Clayburgh, et cetera, down there as much
yeah.
as we can, get them involved?
Absolutely. I think once we identify our highest priority research needs, and there are a lot of very interesting questions, I mean, from the very immediate, do we want to engage in supplemental feeding, to more longer-term questions about vegetative response, we will certainly put out an RFP with A&M Kingsville and Tech and Texas State and all of our other research partners to help us with this. So.
It would be good to take a look at exotic grasses like buffle grass, too,
yeah.
to the extent that there is a fair amount there or some, and watch how that proliferates, if it does.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a key question. I think, you know, sort of our working hypothesis that because of the proliferation of a lot of these exotic grasses in South Texas and reduced grazing pressure, that we may see more wildfires and heightened intensity of wildfires because of that increased fuel load, and that's certainly going to have implications for those natural systems down there, and it needs to be a key area of focus for us. So, yeah, good point.
Are you also, I mean, assuming working with the adjacent landowners, because, I mean, there's a whole bunch of land, you know, there was lots and lots of land that was burned, and I'm assuming everybody wants to sort of have help where to go and how to look at it.
Yeah, I think everybody is keenly interested. I think, and Lynn, if you want to come up and provide some commentary, it's my understanding it impacted around 60,000 acres adjacent to it. But Lynn, will you introduce yourself and join us?
Chairman and Commissioners, my name's Lynn Palasik, and I'm the Region 4 Wildlife Director down in South Texas. the rough figures on how many acres burned, there's all kind of numbers bouncing around. You know, we lost, like I said, 95% of our 15,000 acres. We've heard everything from 60,000 additional acres to 100,000. And so we really don't know yet. We worked very closely with our neighbors, trying to keep the fire on us once it jumped FM 133 and prevent it from going to the neighbors. But the wind originally came from the south, burned through us all the way to the ranches on the north. Then about 5:30 Saturday morning, it turned out at the north, sent the fire back. And by the time Saturday afternoon came, it was heading to the west. So that fire was just moving everywhere. And the tremendous fuel load, it was a wildfire. It's going to be hard to compare it to the effects of prescribed burns due to the intensity of the fire. But we do have vegetation transects that probably 30 years worth of data that we're going back in, GPSing those points, and we'll be able to compare the new vegetation that grows to those historical locations. And the photo points that we did those already last week, and GPS those and have it set up. And you know, we're going to get together, as you can imagine. I mean, if your house burned down, you got a lot of things to take care of. And right now the guys are securing the area, our perimeter fence, going and patching it, and the next thing's the water system and getting it back online. The two wells went out. We had a power surge when that research building burned down, so we're trying to get contractors out there to get that going. And but the wildlife seemed to do pretty good. We flew surveys last Thursday and Friday to replicate the surveys that were done before the season. You know, saw a few dead deer, probably only 20 to 30. Saw 595 live ones, and so that's pretty good for 95% burn. Yeah. And so we didn't experience a lot of mortalities that we can see. We still saw a quail running through the ashes, so they found a way to survive.
So. We saw the fences cut in place. Did you go through and actually, I mean, do that around the high fences? I mean, there were places where high fences had been cut, obviously, in anticipation of the fire coming.
Yes, and that was most likely the Forest Service that went in, not for the wildlife's sake. They were probably inside the fence, and they had to find a way to get out of the way of the fire. So they cut the fence and drive their trucks out. So that's what typically took place. But as Mr. Smith said, you know, the damages and the amount of cost, we're trying to gather that, but we could have possibly lost that entire fence, 30 miles of perimeter fence, because a fire that intense burns the galvanized off of the wire, and that thing's going to rust. And so, huge expense.
Ben, thank you, and thanks Mike Berger also, and Scott, and everybody just did a fabulous job in responding to that very, very well. So really appreciate everybody's efforts.
Thank you very much. Committee item number 2, naming state parks and historic sites. Mr. Walt Babney.
Chairman and Commissioners, good morning. My name is Walt Dabney. I'm State Parks Director, and I'm here to talk to you briefly about some issues related to naming of state historic sites. Back in 2002, pursuant to instructions from the state legislature, we took a compilation of parks that were named historic sites or state historical parks and were instructed to rename them all as state historic sites. Some of them were combinations of historic sites and recreational parks. Since 2002, we have lost 20 of those sites. They've been transferred to other operating entities. So I'm before you today to just update where we need to be in our historic site structure in our list of state parks. As I said, in 2002, we went through this exercise. I'm back before you today to talk about several different components of this. Goliad State Park, we are proposing to rename Goliad State Park an historic site. The reason is it is truly a combination of significant historic components of this, as well as a very robust recreational component, which includes camping and hiking and swimming. There's a paddle trail that goes through there and so forth. So it's really a combination. Those of you that remember the discussions on the transfer of historic sites, one of the components also in some of the sites that stayed with us was that they had law enforcement associated with them. both Goliad Park and then next Waco Tanks both have law enforcement officers, and the main reason for that is because of the recreational component of it. Waco Tanks is the second one that we would add to the list, the current list of three combinations of state park and historic sites, and that's because it is also a major historic site, and we have a, following my presentation, a presentation by the current superintendent of Waco Tanks, which I think you'll find to be very interesting on Waco Tanks, where we are out there and why we do some of the things we do, which is an absolute example of why we're considering this as a combination of the two, because it is truly a place where you're balancing major recreational use on top of a very, very significant cultural resource. At Waco Tanks, it is truly an international destination for climbers. It's one of the, fortunately or unfortunately, one of the finest bouldering areas in the world, and the problem with it is that when you start your climbing, you're literally roping up or laying your crash pads on top of the exhibits in the museum. And so Wanda's going to be talking to you in a minute about how difficult it is to balance that. So in both the case of Waco Tanks and Goliad, we would propose that they be named State Park and Historic Site. Since 2002, we have transferred 19 of our sites to the Texas Historical Commission. One site, as you know, the Texas State Railroad, has now been transferred to the Rail Authority. The Nimitz transfer occurred in 2003, and we are completely out of that operation. House Bill 12 instructed us to transfer 18 additional sites, which means with the railroad and the Nimitz, a total of 21 sites. These are those sites that were transferred this year to the Texas Historical Commission. Our recommendation is that we do go through this naming process, which would change, which would eliminate the 18 sites that have been transferred now from our list of sites, and rename Goliad and Waco Tanks to State Park and Historic Sites. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions from anyone? Comment?
Straightforward. I will then place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you, Walt.
Thank you.
Committee item number 3, update on Waco Tanks State Historic Site. Ms. Wanda Oshevsky.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Wanda Oshevsky. I'm the superintendent at Waco Tanks State Historic Site. And I'm here today just to provide some history on the background of the site as well as an update of recent events. Waco Tanks is a very special place, and its story begins with geology. The property is 860 acres, and half of that is made up of igneous rock mountains, a northern mountain as well as an east, west, and east spur. And about 34 million years ago, there was an uprising of magma underneath a limestone formation. And over the millions of years since, erosion has sculpted and weathered and created the scenic mountains that you can see there today. Geology has made it a true oasis in the Chihuahuan Desert. The word Waco means hollow or depression in Spanish, and the natural hollows in the rock capture rainwater. The formations divert the rainwater to the ground, and it creates an environment that supports life in a much richer way than is found in the desert flatlands around the site. Some of those hollows include aquatic environments with fairy shrimp, tadpole shrimp, clam shrimp. There are over 200 species of birds at the site, as well as many different kinds of mammals, such as the bobcat we got the nice shot of there at the bottom. And for thousands of years, Waco Tanks has also, as an oasis, attracted people. It is very renowned for thousands of Native American pictographs at the site, and they span three cultural traditions, from archaic hunting and gathering as well as the Jornada Mogollon culture. And the Jornada Mogollon had a small settlement at Waco Tanks between 800 and 1,000 years ago. And they painted over 200 masks or face-like designs, no two of them alike. It's the largest collection of painted masks in North America. And there are also historic pictographs that still hold a lot of meaning to Native American people living today. These maps show the concentration of cultural resources at the site. There are over 275 rock art localities. It's hard to see 275 dots there, but that's because many of them are dots on top of other dots. It's vertical space that sometimes exceeds 350 feet of cliffs there at the site. And as well, the archaeology nearly extends from fence to fence. Almost all of the ground level at the site, as well as 160 rock shelters, are archaeological localities. In summary, we could say of the archaeology that the entire span of human history in the Chihuahuan Desert is represented at Waco Tanks, in the form of arrowheads, pottery, even human remains that have been located there. And for cultural affiliation, there are three federally recognized tribes, the Kiowa Tribe of Oklahoma, the Mescalero Apache, as well as Isleta del Sur Pueblo, that still continue traditional activities there. In somewhat more recent times, water made Waco Tanks very important as a stop for settlers. It also made it a stop on the Butterfield Overland Mail route in 1858 and 1859. And by 1898, Waco Tanks was a scene of a large ranching operation with over 2,000 head of cattle. And the Escantrias family, that was very important in the history of the region, built a residence there at the site that is still standing. That historic building is our interpretive center. So by the 1950s, Waco Tanks had been many things. It had, since prehistoric times, been a birthplace, it had been a burial place, it had been a sacred site. And in the transition between the 1950s and 1960s, as the land changed hands from the ranchers to developers, it nearly became a lake resort, housing development, and golf course. And as the people of El Paso saw, construction going on there, including a large dam that was built to divert water into a 200-acre lake. And as they saw newspaper articles about midget racing car rides and Old West gunfights and restaurants, they became concerned about the future of the resources at Waco Tanks. So after some action by local officials, Waco Tanks actually was able to become a county park. Legislation that would enable it to become a state park was passed in 1957, but first the county had to purchase it, operate it until it could pay for itself, and then transfer it to the state. And so Waco Tanks was opened as a state park in 1970. It has been used by El Paso and Juarez families and tourists for over 50 years. There are multiple generations of people in the region that have memories of picnicking there and camping when they were growing up. And more recently, Waco Tanks became an intensely popular rock climbing and bouldering destination, as Mr. Dabney alluded to. And that's been going on from the late 1980s to the present. Every November through March, there are hundreds of people from other states as well as other countries visiting the site for its climbing attractions. As a result, the site sometimes experienced extremely high levels of visitation. In the early 1990s, the visitation count exceeded 150,000 people, and for an 860-acre place, it was quite a bit. You'll see later that numbers begin to drop, basically because of action that needed to be taken to protect that site's very precious resources. They dropped to more sustainable levels, and visitation currently is about 25,000 visitors per year, which is about what it can handle. some of the impacts of high levels of visitation in the past were graffiti. Some of that was on Native American pictographs. And to date, the department has spent more than $50,000 removing graffiti from rock art. I'm happy to say that that's a very rare occurrence now, any new graffiti on pictograph images. Damage to plant life occurred as well in the past because of heavy foot traffic. There was erosion of archaeological areas, litter, looting, and fires, sometimes unauthorized campfires in the backcountry of the site. And beginning in the mid-1990s on into about 1998, Texas Parks and Wildlife tangled with the requirement and the necessity to do something to better preserve that site. And in 1998, a public use plan was implemented that was designed to balance recreational use of the site with protection of its resources. And myself, having been there for the last 10 years since that plan was implemented, I am happy to say that it is working. There is an orientation video that visitors watch before they enter that gives them crucial information about protection of the site. There was no such information given, you know, by the county park or in the past. There also are limits to the numbers of people that can be in the management areas of the site at any one time, and those are critical to protecting it from overuse. There are both self-guided and guided access areas, and there are hundreds of both interpretive and recreational tours that are brought in to the guided area every year, which provide visitors with opportunities for birding, for hiking, for bouldering, and to learn about the really unusual Native American pictographs with guides who are trained. There is a trail system that has now completely encompassed the northern mountain, which is the self-guided zone, and now is being built into the guided area. There's extensive resource monitoring done to make sure that we're meeting our stewardship needs. And there are areas that are specially closed to particular activities just for the imperative protection of resources. For example, there are some places where pictographs are located that, of course, the public is welcome to go and see, but climbing activities in those areas aren't permitted, just to protect the pictographs from impact by climbing. Today, there is a wide variety of activities that occur there at the site. There's still extensive climbing and hiking, camping and picnicking. Recreation is a huge component of what we do there. Rock art viewing, with 278 guides that have to date been trained for guiding not just climbing tours, but also pictograph, birding, and other forms of tours. We have bird watching tours regularly scheduled, and special events that are truly special because of the extent of their involvement with Native American cultures that come and share their traditions, their ceremonies, their dances with the public that gets to come and watch. Research there is very interesting and it includes research on microscopic organisms that live in the aquatic environments at the site, as well as research on birds and reptiles. And Native American special use still continues with very strong affiliation that the Native people feel to that site as a spiritual area and as an area that holds memories of their past and continuing culture. And so the challenge of balancing recreation with preservation continues, and in monitoring activities that took place in October of 2007, Texas Parks and Wildlife archaeologists came to assess some of the areas at the site that have higher levels of use than others. And most of those assessments were very good. We found very little impact at most of the areas that were looked at. But one of them, called Mushroom Boulder, which is a very popular climbing area, did suffer impact. You can see there in the photograph as compared with the lower photograph, that there had been some loss of soil in that area and exposure even of a small rock that's there in the bottom shot. And there was about a 10-centimeter loss of soil deposits that were protecting archaeology beneath that boulder. It happens that areas that are very popular for rock climbing and bouldering also tend to hold archaeological deposits that are of great value because of the way overhangs preserve the archaeology beneath. So there was a need to protect the irreplaceable archaeology there by closing Mushroom Boulder to climbing activities. We felt it was very important to share that decision with groups that would be affected, as well as with the public. And in addition to a news release that was put out about the closure and a frequently asked questions list that we distributed and information made available to visitors at the park, we also had a presentation that was literally brought to the climbing community by taking it to an area that was a popular campground for climbers and that is also a commercial guiding service for the climbing community. And this was a cooperative effort between park staff and the cultural resource program. And so we were able to go and speak directly to the climbing community, who turned out in good numbers, about the need for protection of the resources there at Mushroom Boulder. And the presentation was very well received. Of course, that closure does impact the activities of climbers, but there are over 1,000 bouldering areas still remaining open at Waco Tanks, which give them plenty to do. And it gave them a chance to learn more about the site's archaeology and about the fact that when recreation and preservation cannot coexist, you know, typically they can, and that's what we work for, but where they cannot, that we protect the resources. And so all I can say is that Waco Tanks holds a lot of things. It holds diverse meanings for individuals and for cultures. It still holds the public's interest as a recreational destination, and it holds irreplaceable resources that have the potential to teach us much more about the development of culture in the Southwest. And I invite all of you to come and visit. And with that, I conclude and would like to welcome any questions you might have.
Anna, if you could go back to the slide that shows the rock art sites and the archaeological sites. If you could just point out to those who have not been to Waco Tanks where the dam was built to create that lake.
Sure.
While you're doing that mushroom, where this mushroom.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't know if I... Oh, okay. The one up there.
Can you see where the construction of the dam And its construction in 1960 was covered in newspapers as something that was taller than a two-story building and almost as large as a football field. And when it was constructed, this earth here was bulldozed and piled up to create that. Yes, that is why when you're looking at that image, you don't see the blue coloring here. There would have been archaeology there. Some researchers feel a village structure might have been there, prehistoric dwellings, that were bulldozed to make this. And the Mushroom Boulder is located right about here on the western side of the North Mountain.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you, Wanda. Appreciate
your
presentation. Well, can I ask one just quickly, Wanda?
Sure.
So do you feel, I noticed your people coming is going up slightly, kind of on a steady climb. I mean, are you comfortable with that? It looked like you dropped dramatically, obviously, from 10 years ago.
Yes, it did drop from, of course, over 100,000. And there had been a drop around 1993 because before limiting visitors, Parks and Wildlife actually tried limiting vehicles. But that just didn't do the job. And then in 1998, with the public use plan, visitation that fiscal year dropped to about 12,000. And at that time, the capacity of the site, which is 70 people in the self-guided area and up to 160 in the guided area, was not being maximized just because we hadn't had time to train enough tour guides. Staff was mostly giving guided tours at that time. But over the years, as we've been able to enlist volunteer support, we've been able to offer many, many, many more tours into that backcountry area, not just by volunteers, but by commercial guides as well. And so there actually is still potential to raise visitation even more within the limits of the public use plan we currently operate under by putting more tours into that guided area. So there's room to grow and increase both visitation and revenue within what we've structured as necessary to protect the site.
Thank you. Also, one other question. Do we provide guides for actual climbing?
Yes.
We do.
In the North Mountain area.
Here. Are they commercial or are they provided by TPW?
Currently, there are both. Waco Tanks has contracts with four commercial guide services through Texas Parks and Wildlife, of course, that provide guided access into that backcountry guided area of the site. There also are volunteer guides who, in addition, provide climbing tours for the public.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No more questions. I'll move on to committee item number four, acceptance of land donation at Marion County. Mr. Ted Hollingsworth.
Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. In this item, you are being asked to consider the donation of a small tract of land at the Caddo Lake Wildlife Management Area. The Wildlife Management Area actually occurs in parts of two counties, Marion and Harrison County. It's about 8,000-acre area. It's comprised of several tracts, a couple of which were previously subdivisions and were carved up into many, many, many small waterfront tracts. We've been actively attempting to get rid of inholdings or acquire inholdings, get rid of outholdings, make the boundaries more manageable. And a few months ago, we were contacted by an out-of-state owner of four tracts totaling about an acre. That actually sandwiched between one of our boundaries and the water's edge. He has since signed a gift deed, and if you approve this item tomorrow, we will file that gift deed with the county clerk, and we will own that small tract of land. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Right in. Any questions? Comment?
Mark, could I ask?
Certainly.
What, to what extent are there additional inholdings that we want to acquire?
Well, the problem is that some of those tracts have already had homes built on them. So what we're doing is trying to look strategically to see where the boundary is so convoluted or where those inholdings cause so much operational heartache. We've had situations, for example, where homeowners have dug themselves a canal so they can put their boat, take their boat from their front yard to the lake, and they trenched across the WMA. We have other situations where some of the lots we acquired are outholdings. They're just simply a quarter acre lot that's not connected to the WMA in any way. So right now staff is trying to think strategically about how to change those boundaries to make a site that's easier to operate and manage and reduces the number of conflicts with adjacent landowners. Excuse me.
Thank you.
So that is a difficult question to answer. It just we're kind of having to look at those on a subdivision by subdivision basis. But obviously, where we have tracts that are contiguous that give us waterfront access and improve our ability to operate the site, we want to accept those. And hopefully, we're going to get to the point where we're contacting owners of undeveloped tracts about donating those to try and clean up some of those boundary conflict issues.
Any other comments or questions? If not, I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action.
Committee item number 5, land donation, Williamson County. Mr. Corky Coleman.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Corky Coleman with Land Conservation Program. This is an item at Twin Lakes County Park in Williamson County, up close to Cedar Park. This property was deeded to Parks and Wildlife by legislative action to be leased to Williamson County as a county park. There's quite a few facilities on it, boating, is YMCA there. TxDOT would like to donate an additional 6-acre tract to Parks and Wildlife as an addition to the Williamson County Park. And in visiting with TxDOT, we had asked why they wouldn't just give it to Williamson County. If they gave it to the county, they would have to get fair market value for it, either a purchase or a lease. And since the property has a lot of frontage on 183, it was cost prohibitive for the county to take it. If they give it to us, we're still stuck with the 50. That way we lease it to them, and now we lease 56 acres rather than 50.
And what kind of dollars do we lease it for? Is it
a dollar for 99 years?
Yeah, you know, it's that minimal. Kind of
yeah.
Just rollover lease. Yeah.
Okay. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So it's actually us just doing Williamson County a favor.
And text that.
Yes, sir.
Round.
Are there any additional costs?
Not to Parks and Wildlife. Well, the cost for me to do this agenda item and then for an attorney to draw up a lease, but that's it. I'm
sure that's modest.
Yes.
No upkeep or maintenance associated with it.
Corky's high price.
I'd like to visit with you about that.
Yeah. Well, I asked for that.
Carter's been talking to him. We are at this meeting. We're just going to ask for to publish public notice, and I'll come back to you in May for an action item.
Any further comments or discussion on this item? If not, I will ask staff to begin public notice and the process. Committee item number 6, land acquisition in Aransas County. Once again, Corky.
Again, for the record, Corky Coleman with the Land Conservation Program. This is in addition to the Coastal Fisheries Maintenance Yard located in Rockport. It's along Business 35. We have been contacted by an adjacent landowner who wished to sell the two lots that you can see in red, the yellow lots we already own. The yellow lots house the Coastal Fisheries Maintenance Complex. Law enforcement uses that area. And there is a building that houses one infrastructure inspector. So there's three different divisions that use the area. And acquisition of these two lots will give us ownership of the whole city block and allow for any future development that may go on there. We are making an exception. This is the first time you're seeing this item. We're wanting to do it in one meeting. So it is an action item. And the reason we're wanting to do that is because the owner's anxious to sell, and had we taken it to two meetings as we generally do, it probably would have been sold up front of us. He wouldn't have signed a contract to wait for 4, 5, 6 months to sell these two lots.
That's okay, Ann. I mean, we can do it that way. That's fine with us, but I mean.
I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel. Under our policy on land transactions, there's an exception in there for minor cleanup items. The other thing I should point out is that we did do public notices. We published notices 3 separate times in local newspapers about this. So even though it wasn't a two-meeting process, there were public notices published. And I don't believe we got any comments.
No. So with that, this is the motion you'll see before you tomorrow. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any additional comments or questions? If none, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you.
Thank you.
At this time, I will recess the Conservation Committee and turn the gavel over to Commissioner Martin to open.
So I have to bang it.
That's why I feel good.
Go ahead, bang that thing.
Hey, can I take one of these with me? First order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
I'll move. I'll
second. Motion by Commissioner Friedkin, seconded by Commissioner Brown. I'd like to begin with the land and water plan update, Mr. Smith.
Yeah. Thank you. And I guess first order of business is to let everybody know that Lydia Saldana is going to serve as our kind of designated staff liaison to this committee. So looking forward to her working with you in that capacity. Just a couple of things. We have a litany of education outreach programs going on throughout the agency. Lydia is going to give a synopsis here of that in just a moment. And you're going to hear more specifically about a couple of them. Very, very successful programs working to help improve both the participation in the out-of-doors, but also the quality of participation in the out-of-doors. And so excited for y'all to have a chance to talk about that, Commissioner. We just completed a project with the Texas Field Archery Association for a statewide archery tournament for kids. Bernie Kessner, who's our coordinator, has really done a magnificent job with that program. I think we've reached about almost 30,000 kids in 100 schools across the state. So I'm very successful, and we're looking forward to that growing in the future. A trend that we're seeing really across the nation is this issue of lapsed purchasers of fishing licenses. On average, you know, only about in any given year, about 15% of the anglers purchase a fishing license. And so we have a grant from the Recreational Boating and Fishing Foundation to do a direct mail piece to target lapsed anglers and see if we can enhance the purchase of those fishing licenses in the future. So should be an interesting marketing and direct mail project for us. I think y'all have heard about our Nobody's Waterproof campaign. This is a wonderful boating outreach and boating safety campaign that we have launched with LCRA, taking that statewide. Great cooperation between our communications and our law enforcement divisions to help implement that program. Again, very, very successful in reaching boaters around the state to help encourage them on all matters of boater safety. That program is going to be recognized with two national awards. It's going to receive the National Drowning Prevention Association Community Lifesaver Award that was presented recently to the department. And then we have the National Water Safety Congress Award of Merit that is going to be presented to the department. And again, law enforcement and our communications team will be there to receive that honor on behalf of the department. So great program, and we're really excited about it. So thank you.
Thank you. Will all the information be by direct mail, or will there be any email as well?
Lydia, would you come address that? Yeah, thank you.
For the record, I'm Lydia Saldana. This is a direct mail effort. It's a part of a national effort that the Recreational Boating and Fishing Foundation is doing, and they're providing a matching grant to each state. So it's a direct mail effort, and it's going to be overlaid with a national media campaign.
Thank you. Any discussion? We'll move to the next item, which is myself and Lydia. I just want to briefly say a few words. When I first came on, which hasn't been that long now, just a few months, as commissioner, I thought I had an idea of what Texas Parks and Wildlife was about. And as I have been diving into this outreach and education, I realized that I didn't really have a clue. And I don't mind saying so. It's been a tremendous learning. There's vast amounts of projects and programs that reach every age, every ability, every inability, every disadvantage, advantage. It's been incredible. It's been an incredible learning process. It's been fun. I feel like I've been like a child at a candy store or a child at Coastal Expo. I don't know. But for the commissioners that don't quite realize all the behind-the-scenes small projects, but the projects that are being taken on, it's momentous. And for our new commissioner, I think you'll find it interesting as well. So with this, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Lydia.
Thank you, Commissioner Martin. Again, for the record, I'm Lydia Saldana, Communications Division Director. What I'm going to attempt to cover in the next 8 to 10 minutes is a very top-line overview, what Carter calls the view from 30,000 feet of our department education and outreach efforts. There's a lot of them. Now, during this committee meeting, every other commission meeting, we'll be briefing you on a few key programs each time. So you're going to get an in-depth a briefing on a couple of key programs each time. What I'm going to attempt to do here is just to give you a feel for the scope of the efforts across all divisions. Now, some people might ask the question, and the question has actually been asked in the past, why should Texas Parks and Wildlife spend time and resources on education and outreach? Well, the bottom line is, it really is critical for conservation. We operate in a situation where the public owns the wildlife, they make the laws, they fund our agency, they conserve wildlife on private land. So really, an involved and informed public is absolutely critical to us achieving our mission. We believe that caring about resources in Texas begins with the citizenry that becomes engaged and involved. And it's our attempt to involve them by connecting to them through our sites and our many, many different programs. Now, as we head into another sunset review, I think it's important to note that our authority to conduct education and outreach was reaffirmed as a result of the last sunset bill that was passed in 2001. This is actually a piece of the Parks and Wildlife Code, and it states that employees of the department through education and outreach shall expand the wise use and conservation of fish and wildlife and increase participation in outdoor recreation. It also states that it authorizes us to use funds from all of our different sources in order to conduct these activities, and we do. And it requires us to manage these activities so that they are consistent with the department mission, not duplicative, are cost-effective, and can be measured. Now, all the programs that we do in all of the different divisions are based on research that's been conducted over the years that tells us what needs to happen to get people involved and engaged in the outdoors. There are certain factors that come into play, and they're kind of intuitive, but just to kind of review there, for folks to get involved in adopting outdoor activities, they have to have a positive initial experience. We try to do that through many of our different programs. They have to have access to equipment, to a mentor, to the resource, and they have to have support from family, friends, and the community. So we keep all of these things in mind for all of our programs that we do. Now, in terms of our strategy, what our strategy is in our education and outreach efforts is to create stewards. We would like our end goal, which may be a lofty goal, but it's for every Texan to feel like a steward, that they are a steward of the resource. It's a pyramid process. We start with awareness, interest, and appreciation. Some of the programs that would be in that level would be, for example, Expo, I think, is the perfect example of that. That's where we're introducing people, we're making them aware, and we hope that they will gain an appreciation for what we do. Knowledge and skills is an area. For example, if people get interested in it, they may want to take a Becoming an Outdoors Woman workshop, go to an angler ed class to learn a little bit more and hone their skills. Then it moves to a citizen service situation. And this really is the backbone of many of our programs. Our programs run on volunteers. They run on partners, angler education, hunter education, our master naturalist program. At this level of stewardship, folks are getting involved and sharing it. And then finally, again, a person would become a steward. And, of course, our Lone Star Land Steward program is probably the best example of really exemplifying that stewardship ethic in Texas. We think of this as a continuum, and we offer programs at all different levels. So there's going to be programs that hit each of these areas throughout all the divisions at the different levels. We think that's important, and again, it's a continuum that people move across. Now, with that foundation of why we do it and how we do it, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about who does it. Simple answer to that is we all do. It really is a part of everybody's job. The game wardens are a good example, and I kind of leaned over and whispered in Pete's ear here a few minutes ago and found out that education outreach is part of the performance plan of every game warden. Game wardens are out there, hundreds of them are out there. Now, sometimes they do some education with a citation, but most often they are out there doing education and outreach activities in schools and community groups. They're a key part of our education and outreach force. State park rangers, fish and wildlife biologists, we have a cadre of urban biologists. educators, interpreters, both in our state park staff and our wildlife staff, artists, writers, producers, a lot of those are in my staff, and then volunteers. We're all part of the effort to get that message out there and across to Texans. Now, all of our sites play a role as well, and certainly state parks are places to play, and they're outdoor classrooms as well. And it's an opportunity for us to teach folks about the importance of conservation and their role in that. Park interpreters play a key role, and that's a picture of Wanda, I think, before she got promoted, doing her thing there. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah,
good job.
Before and after, actually. And the park interpretive program, it really strengthens that connection by helping the visitors to our parks understand the role and understand their role in conservation. So it's a critical role. I know that's a key focus for Walt. I know that some of our additional positions that we've gotten this year from the legislature will help us expand that program. It's a very critical part of what we do.
Can I make a comment?
Sure.
Can we go back to that slide? I mean, look at the looks on the faces of those children.
Yeah.
So it's mesmerized.
Yeah. It's a cool deal. I did want to spend a few seconds talking about one particular state park, and that's Sheldon Lake. Some of you all may be aware of the Sheldon Lake Environmental Learning Center outside of Houston. Its focus is on reaching urban kids near Houston, near one of the largest urban areas. And this is just an incredible project. If you have a chance to go through it, I encourage you to do that. Last year, they had 4,000 school kids from Houston go through that facility and learn about what we do and why we do it. Also in state parks, a wonderful community outreach program is the Texas Buffalo Soldiers. This program reaches out and tells the story of Buffalo Soldiers and connects kids, particularly minority kids, African American kids, to the heritage of Buffalo Soldiers and to our natural resources. And just by the way, the legislature has designated July as Texas Buffalo Soldiers Heritage Month. This is a great program, really is. Also in the State Parks Division is the Community Outdoor Outreach Program. This is a program out of Tim Hogsett's branch that offers competitive grants, and it puts resources in the hands of community groups, mainly underserved groups that we don't normally serve, and gets them involved in outdoor recreation. We get a really good bang for our buck out of that program. Now, our wildlife management areas are also outdoor classroom. We do field days. We host school groups. We provide teacher training. I would point out that the Angling Wildlife Management Area, I believe it was last year, was it, Mike? We just opened up a new conservation center there, so it's going to give us some more opportunity on our wildlife management areas to deliver these messages. Now, our urban biologists, they meet Texans where they are, and where they are is in the cities. 80% of our population lives in five cities in Texas, and we now have 9 urban biologists that are stationed in all major metropolitan areas, and they deliver more than 400 presentations and workshops and other outreach opportunities exactly where the people are. So this is a real effective thing that we do to get that message out in urban areas. Also in wildlife is the Texas Master Naturalist Program. We recruit citizen volunteers to become outreach proponents. There are now chapters all over the state. We've got over 4,000 volunteers. We've reached 1 million Texans with this program, phenomenally successful, and it has become a national model that's being duplicated in other states. Switching gears a little bit to the fishery side of the house, certainly fish hatcheries are also another site for conservation, education, and outreach. The Texas Freshwater Fishery Center on the inland side and Sea Center Texas on the coastal side each hosts about 60,000 people a year at either facility. We do fishing events, hatchery tours, education programs. And I would point out, and you're going to hear a little bit about a new conservation education center at the Texas Freshwater Fishery Center tomorrow. But that's, again, is just increasing our emphasis on educational programs in our hatcheries. Now, Commissioner Martin mentioned Coastal Expo. This is a mini version of our expo that we do here at headquarters with a focus on coastal ecosystems. We do several events each year, and we reach thousands of children each year through this program. It's a good program. The Neighborhood Fishing Program provides, also in inland fisheries, provides family fishing opportunities very close to home. We're doing regular stockings of fishing holes that are close to where people live. Again, we want people to have a positive initial experience. We've got a lot of people that are trying fishing for the very first time, and thanks to these stocking efforts, they're catching a fish on the first visit. So that's a real positive experience, and it's being duplicated. This year, we're expanding that program thanks to the donation from the Toyota Texas Bass Classic. We're going to be expanding that program to 6 additional lakes We're going to be stepping up a marketing effort, so we're really going to take that program to a new level this year. Now, I did want to spend a couple of slides on the stuff in my shop, so bear with me here. Hunter and boater education, of course, are key of legislatively mandated programs. We reach 30,000 kids in hunter education, 10,000 in boater education each year, so these are key ways that we get that conservation message out. Carter mentioned the archery in schools program. That's been a phenomenally successful pilot, and we're looking at expanding that into even more schools. You met Ernie earlier. I know most of you know him. Some of you, it was the first introduction. Ernie heads the branch in the communications division that their sole focus is on urban outreach in urban areas. And Ernie's got a mantra, and it's partnership. And we really are focusing all our efforts in partnering with community organizations, and we're training them to deliver our programs and our projects and extending our reach even further. We have two outreach specialists, one in Houston, one in Dallas, and that's their sole focus is developing these partnerships and relationships and growing them as well. Angler education, you're going to hear from Ann Miller here in just a few minutes. Our angler education program trains adult volunteers. Again, we train 18,000 youth, 8,000 adults in safe and responsible fishing activities. We do literally hundreds of events around the state. We've got a great partnership with state parks and the free fishing program, and also with inland fisheries with the neighborhood fishing program as well. So we get out there and get a pole in their hands and teach them how to do it. Project Wild is our signature conservation education program. This program is sanctioned by the Texas Education Agency. That's very important. We train hundreds of teachers and other volunteers who deliver this program, conservation education messages, into schools and other settings. Very successful program as well. Ernie mentioned Perry Haynes Ranch, so I won't go into details there. I do want to mention, though, you know, when he mentioned the $2.5 million worth of facilities that we have there as a result of our partnership with Camp Coca-Cola. The Camp Coca-Cola, which is now called the C5 Summer Camp Program, I did want to mention that for a moment because I think it's a wonderful program. It's a multi-year program that kids get involved in. There's a great deal of minorities that are involved, which I think is good. We need to be doing a better job of reaching that audience. And these kids stay in this camp over time. Most of these kids have never been exposed to outdoor recreation. So it's really a great partnership in a number of different ways and a really, really great program. The Becoming an Outdoors Woman workshop that some of you may have heard about was designed to break down barriers to getting women involved. We've been doing that program since 1992. It's become a model for a new program, the Texas Outdoor Family Program, that you'll hear about in a moment from Ashley Matthews. And, of course, Expo. That is our signature and premier education and outreach event. I guess if I had to describe it in a short one sentence, I would say, well, we put up a tent. Well, actually, lots of tents, and we have a show. And for those of you who've been there, I think you know what an incredible event it is. I mean, it's just a wonderful event. Really, really is a signature event for us. Since 1992, we've reached more than 500,000 people with that event. So mark your calendars for the first weekend of October. I want to end by talking about something I'm really excited about for this coming year, and that is getting the Texas Parks and Wildlife magazine in every school in Texas. Thanks to a grant from ExxonMobil, starting in September of 2008, we're going to be developing a new educational section in our magazine. It'll have a companion web presence, and we're going to be providing it to every fourth grade science and social studies teachers, as well as having copies placed in every school library in Texas. We've been talking about this for years. It's something that I've wanted to do for years. There hasn't been a way to do it up until now, and again, ExxonMobil has come through to help us do that. I hope that this whirlwind tour didn't make you dizzy. It's a lot to cover. There's a lot more that I didn't mention, but I wanted to give you just an idea of the breadth and scope of the programs across all divisions. Again, you will have briefings at each of these education and outreach committee meetings that will provide more in-depth information, and we look forward to continuing that process of educating y'all. So, any questions? Or Commissioner Martin, do you have any additional comments?
Just thank you. That's right. Thank you for all the time that you've spent with me on this too.
Not that you need anything else to do, and you may already do it, but I'm curious about the Project Wild and some of these others that are actually working with the teachers already. Do you have a curriculum in place, or is that going to be maybe part of this getting the magazine into the school?
No, there is. The Project Wild is a national, it's a national program. It happens to be based in Texas. So there's a national curriculum. Now, what we've done in recent years under Nancy Herron's leadership is develop Texas-based curriculum that's in working with our wildlife division and fisheries division to customize it and localize it even further. So there's a national curriculum that we're starting to target as well to be a little more local so folks are learning about what's in their backyard as well.
Thank you.
Measurement. I mean, how do you measure these programs, whether they're for their effectiveness? I know sometimes that's not real easy, but how are you trying to do that, Lydia?
Well, there are different measurement evaluation strategies for each program. As part of our sunset process last time, we went through a process that we basically chartered. We have charters for each of our programs. And each of those have an evaluation component, so it varies. For a program, for example, like Becoming an Outdoors Woman, that is a relatively small number of participants, we're actually able to track them over time. Expo, we do a survey that we don't do it every year now. We've done it enough that we think we can do it not an annual basis to get a good feeling of how that effect has been on folks. So each program has a different evaluation strategy. Hunter education, for example, I mean, we've seen the number of accidents go down for the past, 30 years that we've had the program, and that would be an example of a measure there. So it varies by program, but we don't go into a program without having some sort of mechanism to try to figure out were we successful or not.
Okay, good.
I wish we could do more.
Yeah, ExxonMobil, I mean, I know that's an interest of theirs,
yeah,
of how we're going to measure this going forward,
yeah,
effectiveness. And
yeah, we're working all that. It's good. Very complex, and especially over time, and especially to single out any one particular program. As I kind of said up at the beginning, the number of factors that play a role, so it's hard to get on any one thing. If you do X, Y will happen. We believe it's a combination of all of those things.
Okay, there's still a lot of room for us to expand the public-private relationships with these programs too, isn't there?
I think so. I think there is. There's I think, again, partnerships is the mantra that we all live by. And I know that I'm not unique in this. We all do the best that we can with the resources that we have, and it's a constant challenge of how can we work smarter. And the model of partnering with other organizations and community groups is a good example of that, where we train them, we get them involved and engaged in our stuff, and then they go on, deliver the program, and we can move on to developing a relationship with a new organization. So that's sort of the way that we're doing things now.
Can you elaborate a little bit on your relationship with ExxonMobil in that regard?
What do you mean exactly?
Well, when you say that they are assisting in getting these magazines put into the school.
Well, they've basically funded a grant. They funded a grant that will allow us to pay for the additional copies, that will allow us to put the section together, that will allow us to physically get it out.
Okay.
So they've had some input on the front end. They won't be reviewing content or anything like that. It's going to be a standalone educational section, and again, I'm just thrilled about it.
Good.
Yes.
Will the particular magazines that are put out have a special focus in there to try to acquaint these, I guess they're going to be new readers, with options and take advantage of the fact that this is their first look?
Yeah, and it's going to be a special section that can be pulled out that will also be up on our website, and a lot of the attention is going to be to drive folks to be aware of what those resources are. So it's an educational, we're going to be looking at kind of what they're looking at the schools. We want to tie it back to lessons plans. We had a focus group of teachers involved in it. We want the section to be something that's going to be used in the schools, and we're really working toward that.
I wanted to make a brief comment on the Coastal Expo. And talking about partnerships, there was partnerships there with the city and the county, and I think there were over 100 volunteers. I think they averaged about 2,000 children on Friday, about another 2,000 children on Thursday and Friday. And they was just very much of a hands-on for the children to get involved in seeing the fish, touching the different the crabs that were in there, and the snails, and So it was a lot of excitement, and it was very joyous to hear, you know, 2,000 children screaming with glee as they were getting dirty and getting their hands wet and really hands-on. And there was one particular event that I found interesting. I had no idea that we dove into so many different areas, but it was a blind birding. And it was a woman who is technically, legally blind, who headed it up. And she has taken this on as her mission and is partnered up with the folks there. And how she did it, you had a partner that could see. And so those that were able to see, I was blindfolded. And she led it through. So it's interesting taking it on strictly through other senses and having your partner describe, you know, what bird was singing and the color and where it was. And it was a whole new experience, and I think it's wonderful that we offer these great projects to disadvantaged individuals. And I wanted to share that because it was really quite humbling, really, to see how everybody worked. And I believe they said there were over 100 high school volunteers, which brings in more young people to carry on this legacy. So just wanted to make a brief mention on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Continuing on to committee item number 3, C-Camp, presented by Mr. Paul Hammerschmidt.
Chairman, Commissioners, Mr. Smith, my name is Paul Hammerschmidt for the record. One of the things that was really brought up with Lydia's talk was the issue of partnership. And my presentation today is about an outreach and education program where we and our partners have been very successful for many years. It's called C-Camp, or Summer Experience in Aransas. This takes place in Rockport, Texas, and it's been popular since 1998. C-Camp and their partners and their volunteers help provide a broad educational and experiential opportunity for many Aransas County children, aka fun and learning. Here are our partners. The Maritime Museum is the lead organization. They organize it all. City of Rockport, Goose Island State Park, Fulton Mansion, and the Coastal Fisheries Division. In 2007, there were 137 children from first through fifth grade that went to C-Camp. And the C-Camp season is divided into 5 one-week sessions, each for children of different ages, first and second, third and fourth, and finally fifth graders. Each day's activity run from 9 a.m. to noon, and throughout the week, the kids are exposed to a broad range of activities and knowledge, including maritime history, local history, coastal living, conservation, and marine environment. The last 2 days are the wet days. They're the third and fifth graders, and they get to get wet and dirty out there. Now, we'll pace through a few of these here. Prior to the field activities, everyone gets a chance to get oriented, and they get a lot of safety training, including boater ed and that, what to wear, what not to wear. And the fun, learning begins when paddling with kayaks, learning how to fish. Let me let the slides catch up with me here. Learning how to fish and using some gears that they've never used before, like a cast net. We do a dry run on this with our OCAD things, and the kids have a blast with it. Then they get to tour the bay and learn firsthand about the habitats. And then the getting dirty and wet part is to work in the habitat itself. And again, did I mention getting dirty and wet? We'll let this pace through. There are so many activities. The kids work together with our biologists and volunteers. They get to go out on their own, practice their cast netting, work together, and try to figure out that blasted net.
Yeah, which ends up.
And then those who don't want to go wading, we have touch tanks where they can touch the critters, get up close and friendly with them. And again, the do bag seines. Now, this is a real short presentation, and we would like to cordially invite all of you to participate in the 2008 Seed Camp, and you know, we might even find you a T-shirt or something.
What are the dates?
Let's see. Starts the middle of June and goes through the middle of July. And don't forget, don't bring flip flops.
Oh, yeah.
I do a lot of outreach in the agency, and actually one of my hats is outreach coordinator for the Coastal Fisheries Division. And I've always subscribed to the philosophy expressed in a tagline by Bill Cosby. If you all remember the cartoon Fat Albert, and if you'll allow me to paraphrase it, you all have fun now, but watch out, you may learn something. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Any other discussion? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Will you email those dates to all the commissioners?
Yes, sir.
Paul, thank you.
We'll continue on to committee item number 4. Texas Outdoor Family Program, Ms. Ashley Matthews.
Good morning, Commissioners, Mr. Smith. My name is Ashley Matthews, and I'm a training specialist within the Urban Outdoor Programs within the Communications Division. It is my responsibility to manage the Outdoor Woman and the Texas Outdoor Family Programs. It's the latter of these that I'd like to speak to you about today. For years, our department has provided programs to educate and expose children to the outdoors, but many of these programs may have been missing a really crucial component, that is the inclusion of influential adults and parents. Recently, the department has begun to offer the Texas Outdoor Family Program, which consists of hands-on educational workshops where together families learn a variety of outdoor skills. Before I tell you about how we deliver the program, I'd like to tell you a little bit more about its history. The Texas Outdoor Family Program is modeled after the Becoming an Outdoors Woman program, which the department has had success for nearly 15 years. That model wishes to eliminate participation barriers for participants. In this instance, we're specifically addressing participation barriers of lack of experience, as well as self-confidence, and in the children's specific instance, support from families. Essentially, our workshops provide an introduction to overnight camping, and families learn the basic skills necessary to replicate that experience for themselves in the future. Since the fall of 2006, we've offered 6 workshops across the state, and just this spring, we'll offer an additional 6 events. As you can see, we're starting to roll along and have great success. We provide the program through 2 different delivery systems. First, partnerships with municipal park and recreation departments. And our second delivery system is through state parks. Our goal when partnering with local park and recreation departments is to effectively duplicate ourselves. After expressing an interest and willingness to work with the department, cities involve themselves in a 3-year mentoring process where they are provided key resources to help host events. We provide them the Texas Outdoor Family Workshop Manual, which provides specific event management advice as well as curriculum for activities. We provide them promotional assistance, we loan them equipment, and we provide them access to trained volunteer instructors to hold the classes. After this 3 years, the city should be able to provide these workshops on their own without direct involvement from the department, so that I can go on and partner with other cities and expand the program. The second delivery system we've recently embarked on is through state parks. We're extremely excited about this situation. For many, many years, Walt Dabney has supported the idea of providing families an opportunity to get enthused about the outdoors through camping. And now it appears that we have the right mix of interest, resources, and public interest to make that happen. For this fall, Parks plans to offer 10 outdoor family workshops in 4 different state parks. And based on that experience and the support of sponsors, we hope to roll out that program through state parks in the next 2 years. Current research indicates our success in providing these programs to families who are not already involved in and engaged in the outdoors can be very positive on several fronts. We would be reconnecting children in nature and help ensure consistent and repetitive exposure by encouraging family support. Additionally, we'll be recruiting new outdoor enthusiasts and we'll be setting a firm foundation for a conservation ethic amongst our future stewards. To evaluate these impacts, procedures are already in place to survey participants prior to and after their visit to a workshop. We ask specific questions about their level of experience before attending and how they feel their actions and opinions may have changed after participation. The next step, with the assistance of university experts, is to survey families 1 to 2 years out to see how their behavior has been impacted. Participants in Texas Outdoor Family Workshops are similar to becoming an outdoor woman attendees. Typically, both are inexperienced or novice outdoor users and have expressed enough interest in the outdoors that they've paid to play. We believe we will see similar positive results in our families, these being increased park use and license sales, the adoption of outdoor recreational hobbies, recognition of Texas Parks and Wildlife and its mission, and positive changes in opinions about conservation and traditional management methods such as hunting. To conclude, I'd like to share with you a video news release that will be sent out to news stations across the state in April to help us promote the spring and fall events. And then I'll be happy to take any questions you may have.
Thank you all. All right, fire when ready.
Fire!
Very good.
Coach Perrin is helping his daughter, Lucy, shoot an air rifle for the first time.
That's what they call it, a second skin?
It's just one of many activities at Texas Parks and Wildlife, Texas Outdoor Family Workshop.
Go ahead, fire. Great shot. Those are all very good shots.
In addition to basic camping skills, the program includes classes such as archery, kayaking, and Dutch oven cooking.
I think it's part of trying to give the kids a well-rounded education, as much as anything else. And so kind of getting away from the health and culture of the city life.
The new program is based on Texas Parks and Wildlife's popular Becoming an Outdoors Woman Workshop, which began 15 years ago and has since graduated over 3,500 women.
Most of the families, it was the child or the children that motivated their interest. Evidently, they had expressed some interest in the past in going camping or fishing or doing something outdoorsy. And the parents evidently didn't have that expertise already to share with their children.
The program is targeted for families who have never tried any outdoor activity, like the Lou family, who put up a tent for the very first time.
The experts come out and teach you how to put out the tent, how to choose the location, the right location to put out a tent, and choose from the good ones, the better ones, from the social one like that. That's very important. People are further and further disconnected from outdoor recreation and of the love of the outdoors. But there's some sort of internal spark, some sort of interest that we're all born with. We just have to be shown how to do these things. And it's easy enough to do if we take the time to do it.
Now we do this.
For Texas Parks and Wildlife, this is Lydia Saldana.
How much have we spent to put it up?
Not much time, right? Any questions? All right. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Committee item number 5, Fishing and State Parks Initiative, Ms. Ann Miller.
Good morning, Mr. Smith and Commissioners. I'm Ann Miller. I'm an aquatic education coordinator. I work in the Communications Division and the Urban Outdoor Program. So this project that I'd like to tell you about is our free fishing events in Texas State Parks. It is a partnership program between the State Park Division and Angler Education Communications Division. The project was begun about 4 years ago, trying to meet the public need for a place to teach kids how to fish. We were receiving calls pretty much weekly in my office from parents who wanted a place to take their kids to teach them how to fish. We have a lot of volunteers across the state who are involved in teaching specific groups how to fish, their own scout troops, their own church groups, their own school groups. But for just a public place to learn how to fish, there really weren't very many opportunities. So that, coupled with the fact that parents could take their kids to a state park and fish without a license, seemed to be the perfect marriage of a way to put a program together. So in 2005, we only had four parks that piloted this project. Now we have 14 parks in FY08 who are involved in teaching kids how to fish, and we have over 60 events that have been planned so far. And these are parks all the way from Eisenhower up on Red River down to Galveston Island, Palmetto State Park, so we're really trying to do it across the state. The goals of this fishing program are, of course, to teach those basic fishing skills to people who have and to recruit new anglers. We want to introduce them to the fact that there's great fishing in our state parks, they don't have to have the license. We still find a lot of people not knowing that they don't have to have a license to fish in state parks. And of course, we want to increase stewardship of park and water resources and the perception among the public that they do have a responsibility and can affect some good change in our water and park resources. In order to determine if we are being successful with these programs and reaching our goals, we do survey both youth and adults at each of these events. Last year, our youth surveys showed us that 98 youth caught their very first fish at one of these programs. 62% of the kids had never fished before or had fished fewer than five times. 39% of the adults had very little or no fishing experience. 82% of the adults gained new information at the event. And 43% of the adults had not been to that park before. So we are definitely meeting those goals that we had laid out in advance. So this program is funded through the Angler Education Program, which gets our money from a Sport Fish and Restoration Act grant. So we pay for contract fishing event coordinators and we train them to go to each park and put on these events. The training includes hands-on stations that we train them in putting on these events where the kids go from station to station, learning how to tie on their hook, learning how to set up their basic tackle, and learning about the fish and the habitat and the ways they can, through their actions, have positive impacts on that habitat. So it is a pretty comprehensive program. I think it was really revealing that the parents said that they were learning something at each of these events right along with the kids. We also help with equipment and supplies, educational materials, giveaways, things that the kids and parents can take home to help extend that fishing interest and knowledge. On the state park side, it's very important that the state parks recruit and supervise those fishing event coordinators at each of their sites. And they provide the on-site support at each event, so that at each event there are park people there, they're welcoming the folks to the event, and they are making sure that the facilities right there work well for each event. But in addition to parks and our angler ed fishing event coordinators, the community support is vital. So at these events we often have some donated goods and services from different businesses in the local community. the fishing event coordinators and the park staff go together to call on some of these businesses and to solicit some support. The marketing program has also created some sponsorship packages. So if a community business wants to support in a little bit more substantial way, there is a method for them to contribute, and we are tracking those contributions very carefully. We've had some wonderful coverage in newspapers, radio, and local TV. If I may, just a minute, I'd like to quote at a recent event in Huntsville. The Huntsville newspaper on March 16th had a very nice article about an event that they had just recently, and I'd like to quote this. Some of the parents themselves had never fished before and were as delighted as their children to be learning how to fish. "We caught a fish, and we've never caught a fish before," said excited mom Sherry Roberts from the Woodlands. Roberts, with her husband and twin sons, were camping at the park and planned to come back next month to participate again. "I've never been fishing, and I never wanted to fish, but I like this," said Roberts. Roberts' son, Evan, caught his first fish with mom's help. She was probably more excited than he was. So, again, we've got over 60 events. I'd love to have some of you, or each of you, come to one of the events. They are all on our website, so there's information about them there. I'd love for you to come. And we'll be having basic fishing classes, we'll have junior angler classes, and some derbies. So some of these kids want to actually compete and win prizes. And we do have prizes. We would like to give away fishing equipment at each of these events just to encourage those kids to come back and go fishing. And then there are going to be some advanced fishing classes. Eisenhower State Park is having its Tech Soma on the Fly. This is their third fly fishing event. For the last 3 years, it's been growing every time, and that'll be in June. It'd be a wonderful event. A lot of people from the Dallas-Fort Worth area attend that event. As you can see, at the beginning, some kids are a little bit squeamish about some of those aspects of fishing. This little girl ended up catching her first fish, and you can see by the quote there from this little child that she's a convert already. Thank you very much. And I'll be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Just keep expanding it.
Yeah, we would like to. We want to expand it.
Yes, the momentum.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further comments, discussion?
No. Thank you, Margaret. I think that was great.
So,
give the overview.
Thank you. It helped me throughout the last few weeks of trying to get a handle on this. You know, if I can take just 2 minutes or so, I want to pass along a compliment, and this will go to Colonel Pete Flores. Last week, Commissioner Falcon and I were in Zapata for a legislative visit, basically showcasing the partnership of the game wardens with for Homeland Security, with the Border Patrol, Sheriff's Department, DPS. Did I miss anybody? Pretty much. Good. And after one of the presentations, I had several individuals come up to me from other agencies, Border Patrol, DPS, the sheriff from Zapata that we'll be hearing from later on today or tomorrow. Basically really complimenting our game wardens and our law enforcement, and they said our game wardens held a certain professionalism, a certain ethics, integrity that was noticeable, and they shined everywhere they went, and they were very complimentary of their skills and just how they're handling the situation down in South Texas. So I wanted to pass that on to you, Colonel, because it's always nice when you have individuals from other agencies come and compliment your law enforcement and your game wardens. So I wanted to pass that on to you, that many people from other agencies are looking at what you're doing. So thank you. I wanted to share that with the rest of the commissioners.
Thank you, Martin. Congratulations, Pete.
So, and at that, I conclude the Outreach and Education Committee, and And I'll pass this on to...
What is our plan here, Carter?
We're going to go back to Commissioner Bivens and let him open up executive session.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I will now reconvene the Conservation Committee. Items 7 and 8 will be discussed in executive session, and we will now recess for that session. Therefore, I would like to announce that pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act, an executive session will be held at this time for the purpose of deliberation of real estate matters under Section 551.072 of the Texas Open Meetings Act, and seeking legal advice from the General Counsel under Section 551.071 of the Open Meetings Act, and deliberation of a prospective gift or donation under Section 551.073 of the Open Meetings Act, and deliberation of personnel matters concerning the internal auditor search under Section 551.074 of the Open Meetings Act. We shall now adjourn to executive session.